2,468. I just want to make sure we're on board. Ready?
This is the 91st.
This is the
91st, 91.
Welcome. I'm going to call the meeting to order. I can't count that high, but Peter Lamb tells me that from his notes that this is the 91st meeting of the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee. I'm not that old, but I'm calling the meeting to order. My name is Robert Budnitz. I'm from the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, retired in Berkeley, and I have the privilege of chairing this committee this year. I'll start just briefly with calling to order and making introductions of our members and our consultants and our support staff. And then the next order of business will be public comment. So I'm going to introduce the other members of the committee. To my left is Peter Lamb. Dr. Peter Lamb has been on the committee for three-year terms, and he's a retired member of the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. To his left is Dr. and Professor Per Peterson, who's a professor at the Department of Nuclear Engineering at the University of California in Berkeley. And he's in his fourth term, I think. We serve three-year terms, or maybe the fifth. I'm not sure, Per. He'll tell us. A professor of nuclear engineering, and all three of us on the committee are nuclear engineers. We have two consultants at the table and our legal counsel, whom I'll introduce next. To my far right is Furman Wardell. He's been a consultant to the committee for about two decades, maybe a little more, and is retired from Duke Power, where he did a lot of important work on nuclear safety of the Duke Power plants. On the far left is Rick McWhorter. Rick is the other consultant to the committee. And he's been with the committee about 3 years, and currently his main other work is working for the minority owner at the North Anna nuclear plant in Virginia. But before then, he did nuclear engineering. He was on the staff and was actually an inspector at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for a while, nuclear Navy, and another expert on nuclear engineering. To my immediate right is Robert Wellington, who's been the counsel to the committee. There's an office in Monterey that supports us, and he's the head of that. He's been the counsel to the committee since its inception, which is 20-something years ago. So this is the committee and its support staff. Just want to introduce one other person that's really important for our committee's operation, and that is Hector Garcia, to my left. Is the PG&E Diablo Canyon liaison to the committee. That is, whenever we need anything from PG&E or have any interface with them, he's our interface and liaison, and we go through him. And we couldn't function at all without the strong support that we've always received from PG&E, for which I'm thankful. So without any further ado, unless any of the committee members here want to say anything before we start, I was going to say that the next item is public comment.
On matters not on the agenda.
Oh, on matters not on the agenda. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, this is the session for public comments on items not on our agenda. Therefore, I am delighted to acknowledge the presence of Judge Alex Carlin, a former colleague of mine, who is currently a member of the Decommissioning Engagement Panel, and invite him to address the committee on items not on our agenda.
Thank you, Dr. Lamb, if I may refer to you in your formal title. And thank you all for having me just for a minute.
Welcome.
Thank you. I am a member of the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel, which was formed in May of this year. And we have invited you, as I think you know, to our meeting tonight, and we really look forward to the opportunity to have you there. We have an interesting agenda, and you may find it useful to see what we do. We're an interesting entity. We were created by PG&E at the behest of the PUC to help be a conduit for information between the community and the company for decommissioning matters. And PG&E has supported us carefully and thoroughly throughout that process. We've had monthly meetings on the topics of decommissioning funding, decommissioning process, the reuse of the lands at the Diablo Canyon facility, all 12,500 acres of the lands, and the reuse of the facilities. And so these are the things we've covered. And it's a good group. I want to introduce two other members of the engagement panel who are here today. Nancy O'Malley, Dr. O'Malley, is a physician. She's a member of the panel. And you're very familiar with Linda Seeley. She's a member of the decommissioning panel as well. We have 11 members. And it's a good group, and we all work pretty hard. I have sent you a chart that I think provides a comparison of the various. Excellent. And I hope you'll have a chance to look at that, because I think you're having Dr. Victor come tomorrow, and I've talked briefly with him, and the creation of the panel was specifically intended to be quite different and from the songs panel, which was given as an example of something we wanted to avoid at all costs. That was PG&E's instructions for the formation of our panel. And so you will see some differences. And we are certainly different from you, because you're a creature of a state creation and are appointed by state agencies. And we're different from that as well. So I look forward to your being able to come to our meeting tonight if possible, and I could answer any questions you might have. I am not a formal chairman or an emissary from the committee. I'm just one of the members.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, just to amplify on something he said, normally at meetings like this, in fact always, we always have an evening session tonight.
Right.
But we're not having an evening session tonight because we're all going to the community engagement panel meeting, which starts at 6:30 downtown, and we're therefore not going to have an evening meeting tonight.
Thank you. That's great. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Hi. Good afternoon, Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee committee members and staff. My name is Dr. Gene Nelson. I serve in a volunteer capacity as the legal assistant and government liaison for an adverse intervener in proceeding A1608006, which of course everybody here in this room knows about. But for those that might be watching on television, whatever, that is PG&E's proposal to voluntarily close the highly functioning Diablo Canyon power plant in 2025. CGNP entered that proceeding in 2016 as an adverse intervener, meaning we are heartily opposed to this plan, as this plant serves many important roles. We note a few items here. First of all, the CPUC rejected Californians for Green Nuclear Power Incorporated application for rehearing in a public meeting on the 25th of September 2018. And if you go out to the PUC website and you bring up the docket, you'll discover something very interesting. You'll discover that the status of that application is still marked as reopened, meaning it is not in any shape or form a legal finality. CGNP has prepared a very vigorous legal response. Unfortunately, I'm not yet able to, it's still embargoed, but I can tell you it's quite large, around 900 pages, we intend to keep the plant open and make history in the process. So with no disrespect intended, we intend to put the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel out of business. Thank you very much.
And any further public comment?
Good afternoon. David Weissman, Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. Apropos of the announcement of the public meeting tonight of the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel, the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility, having observed the panel since its inception, has put together a set of formal written comments on our own analysis of the panel to date and suggestions for questions that remain unanswered and a direction for the panel to head. And that document, if anyone wants to review it before the meeting tonight, is at the top of our homepage, which is www.a4nr.org. That's a4nr.org. It's right there, top of the homepage, and you can download that PDF file and take a look at it before the meeting tonight. Thank you very much.
Is that the document that you sent us the other day?
That's correct.
So we have it then.
You do have that document electronically, but it's now posted for the public at large.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Linda Seeley, and I'm speaking on behalf of Mothers for Peace. I have been looking at the agenda, and I don't think there's anything about this, but Mothers for Peace has a concern that we would like you to investigate. It's about the reactor in Unit 1, the reactor vessel. In 2003, it was deemed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission as being among the five most embrittled reactor vessels in the U.S., okay? There's something that we don't understand about this process. They make little things, I believe they're called coupons, that are made of exactly the same material that the welds inside the reactor vessel are made of. Correct. The reactor vessel for Unit Number 1 was manufactured in 1967. And at that time, when they manufactured that reactor vessel, they didn't under the knowledge about welds, exposure to high level levels of radiation, and high levels of heat were not fully explored. I don't know if they are yet, but at that time for sure. And apparently the welds in Unit 1 have a higher concentration of copper in them than the ones that are more current. I don't know if there are any really current ones, but anyway. And apparently copper, when it's exposed to all of this heat and radiation, becomes brittle, but they didn't know that at the time. So then they have these coupons that are made of the same, and it's not just copper, it's a mixture of all kinds of metals, I guess, that are in these welds. So they take out a coupon and they test it for microscopic cracking, and this is how they made that determination that it was one of the most embrittled reactors. So in 2003, now this is the part I'm a little bit confused about, because apparently there are two tests that they do. One is with the coupons, and the other is with an ultrasound inside the reactor vessel.
That's fair.
And they were scheduled to do a test of the apparently they've taken out three coupons, and they say that's enough to take out for the entire life of this reactor vessel, because we know that through our mathematical calculations that it is okay. Is that right?
The basis on that is that the coupons are located in places in the reactor that see substantially higher radiation dose rates than the vessel itself.
Okay.
And so those coupons have already been exposed to doses equivalent to much longer life on the vessel. And so at this point, there's not any need to do any more investigation, because they already have been exposed beyond what the vessel would experience in its life.
Okay. Which doesn't really make a lot of sense to me, but I'll let that go. Okay. But then there's also the ultrasonic testing that they do inside of the reactor vessel to look for more than microscopic cracking.
Right.
They applied for an exemption to that test. PG&E applied and was given an exemption for that test that was due to happen in 2015. And they were allowed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to never do another test inside of that reactor vessel until the end of its lifetime. I brought this up to the NRC when they were here about a month and a half ago, and they said, yeah, that's true. They did that because of some calculation. I don't know what. But the way I am thinking, maybe this is impractical or maybe it's illusionary or something, but if I were PG&E and I wanted to prove that my reactor vessel, which had been identified as one of the most embrittled reactors back in 2003, I would want to go inside there and say, hey, how is this thing looking on the inside? Is it getting more cracked? They're going to do an outage of Unit 1 in February, and they could voluntarily do that. It would cost, I think, about $200,000 for them to do that, if I'm not mistaken. That's what I was told. If they don't have the money to do it, maybe we could raise money. The community could raise the money for it. I would be willing. Mothers for Peace would be very willing to take on that responsibility for that. If they would agree to do it, we will raise the money for it. And we hope that it proves to be not further embrittled, that it's safe. But boy, oh boy, would I ever like to know for sure. So that's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you.
I wasn't aware of the exemption request and its subsequent approval.
Yes.
That being the case,
we will look into this.
Right. I would recommend next fact-finding team to make further inquiry.
Thank you very much.
I ask Rick to see if we can get that on our December agenda.
I just want to correct one thing that you said inadvertently. You implied that the vessel is brittle. It's not brittle. It's important to understand. All these metals are susceptible to embrittlement in certain circumstances, okay, as opposed to being brittle themselves. All right.
Like if cold water.
Well, right. They're susceptible to being embrittled at very cold temperatures, which is why they're always kept at hotter temperatures where they're not brittle, but they're in fact ductile. Ductile is the word that's the opposite of brittle.
Exactly.
So I want to make sure I understand. I wasn't calling you on an error there.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to explain to the public that there's a difference between being brittle and being susceptible to embrittlement.
Exactly. Right. And I meant to say that because
I
meant if it had to go through a cold shutdown, then it could possibly become very brittle.
No. If it were to shut down in an orderly way.
Yeah, but not an orderly way.
No, I understand. So let me say, if it shut down in an orderly way, it's not going to have any forces that are going to cause it to be any brittle fractures.
Right.
The danger is that it's sitting there hot.
Right.
And cold water is injected, and that cold water is catches the vessel, if it was sentient, which it isn't, unawares.
Right.
And that cold, that's sort of an anthropomorphic way of describing. Mm-hmm. And that part of the vessel that was suddenly exposed to cold water would become embrittled. And that's not good. So that having been said, about 6 or 7 years ago, the NRC, which has a regulation governing this, which is called 10 CFR 50 parts, 10 CFR 50, 61, okay?
Okay.
It's called the pressurized thermal shock rule, but that's what it's part 61, which governed that phenomenon and how it's regulated. was amended to another Part 61A, which is also in the regulation, which in 61A takes account of newer knowledge than Part 61. Part 61 was written in 1980, 81, and 82. This was written 30 years thereafter, based on a whole lot of much more advanced understanding than we had, than we, the whole community, had back when the original rule was written.
Well, if we can be reassured that it's safe, we would be very happy.
All right, so I just want to say, the Part 61 enables a plant to do modern, much more realistic analysis. The other was highly conservative, and demonstrate that the vessel is nevertheless safe against that cold water injection. And PG&E, at the time when Part 61 was announced, did an analysis, and they said they didn't even have to invoke Part 61A. They could they could show that they were okay under Part 61. But recently they've done the analysis for Part 61A, is my understanding, and the analysis is robust, and it shows that there isn't any susceptibility to actual embrittlement under this cold water injection scenario, and you can read that analysis, or I can send you to where it is. It's in a PG&E report and an NRC review of it, which demonstrated to the NRC staff and to the professional community that in fact that scenario will not lead to a brittle fracture. And boy, were some of us that were concerned about that relieved when we found that out, because it was a big concern. It was concerned to our committee as well as to the more general community.
And the chairman is exactly right. If you remember correctly, Ms. Steele,
you're allowed not to remember everything.
We from the committee at the time of Part 61A and Part 61 came into focus. Part 61A was not mandatory. Okay, so the PG&E, the licensee, had a choice to go either way, and they chose at that time to go with the more conservative part, which is original Part 61. And the coupon data came out to be reassuring. As Dr. Peterson was saying, the coupon measure fluence level.
Right.
And they tested it.
And so, does that have anything to do with the ultrasonic inspection?
Which is a separate issue, you know.
Okay.
On your ultrasonic exemption request and its subsequent approval, as you heard earlier, I think we will make further inquiry there.
So I think we can wrap this up by saying what Per Peterson said. We'll give it another look because it's fair enough to do that.
Okay.
But the last time we looked, and I think I can speak for the three of us, but I believe it's in our report, we were convinced that the vessel was not susceptible to this phenomenon, nor would it be for the subsequent until 2025 irradiation.
Okay.
And we were convinced of that. On the other hand, it's a fair comment, and we'll look at it again.
All right. Thank you very much.
As a matter of fact,
about 4 or 5 years ago.
I raised the unpopular view on this committee at that time by making an allegation, not an assertion. Is the agency, which I meant the NRC, promulgating Part 61A, was it politically motivated, quote-unquote?
Oh, heck no.
Right. At that time, it was awfully unpopular on this committee. The reason I said that was based on the consequences of Part 61A. Without 61A, some reactor vessel would not be permitted to go for another 20 years. With 61A, everybody passed.
Oh.
At that time, I raised that point.
Sure.
But now I am persuaded 61A
is better science.
Is based on better science.
Okay.
Let me add.
But we'll look at it again.
This very subject came up about 2 years ago. Mr. John Giesman, attorney for A4NR, brought this very item to us and complaining very similar, like you did, where you're always skipping inspections. We looked into that. We saw all the correspondence between PG&E and the return from NRC. We were satisfied that the that not doing that rest of that test, it was just a partial portion of that test, and it wasn't because of the money, it was because of the geometry inside the reactor vessel. They couldn't get the instruments to where they could get a good, accurate read. So we looked at it. It's in one of our reports, and it's probably in some public meeting minutes. We could probably provide those to you if you wanted to see them.
Sure. Love to. Thank you.
Yeah, just finally, none of us here were convinced that it was the money. That wasn't the issue.
Okay.
Okay. It was technical. It wasn't the money.
Okay.
That's an important thing. At least that we didn't think so. Do you agree with that? You're allowed to do anything you want. We still have a quorum.
Sherry Lewis, Mothers for Peace.
Welcome.
I just wanted to ask a question. If I look in open items list on these goldenrod pages, which item would what you're talking about that you said you dealt with 4 or 5 years ago? Would it be, I hope it wouldn't be other items.
Hold on.
Could it be SE?
Hold on.
Let's see. System and equipment performance problems?
Well, there probably was a item that's now closed about that specific, but
right,
I think
but
we
I
have a recurring.
I have these.
Item. No, I've got the item here. It's SE26 on page 4.
Okay, that's what it would it's probably not on here now. Well,
yes, it is. SE26,
okay.
Page
gotcha.
4.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. Yeah, that's exactly right.
And it's, if you'll see on there, we'll look at it again in the next two outages. So we do review this periodically.
And it's also, no, that's right. That's right. Any further public comment? Okay, so the next item on our agenda, I promise, Bob Budnitz promised you this will bore you to tears, unless you're really into it, which is our consent agenda. And the only item on the consent agenda today is to approve the minutes of the last public meeting, which was on June 13th and 14th. And the way we do that is we all have copies of it. We've all reviewed it. We're going to turn the pages, and we're going to identify any place where one of us may have found something that doesn't jive with our memory of what happened or is an error or a typo or something. So we're going to go to the minutes of the last public meeting, and it's in the pages that are pink. And if you have one of these, it's the pink ones.
Just a couple of those in the so there's one master copy and two others out there.
Oh, okay. So we'll do this expeditiously, and I'm just going to turn the pages and ask. We're not going to identify typos, which we find from time to time, but things that are substantive. And so I'm just going to ask, has anybody found anything in the first five pages? Okay. How about 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10?
All right, I have one on page 10. This is a description of my presentation, first large paragraph, third full line from the bottom. It says, Mr. McWhorter, opinion that this was not the type of event for which an alert should be required to be called. This had to do with the containment atmosphere issue. I don't think, I probably did say that, but it's not certainly not what I intended to say, that I was expressing an opinion that would be the type of event which an alert should not be required to be called. It certainly was one it would not be desired to be called out.
Well,
and they did do subsequent changes to the emergency action classification and the procedures to the prevent recurrence in that situation. But
so let's accept that change without any other comment probably. And you'll pass that along?
I will.
Okay. I'm on page 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Anything else? 11, 12, 13, 14, 15?
Mr. Chairman, yeah. I like the way you're doing business here. Five pages at a time. This speed up the process five times.
My purpose is to keep the boredom down.
Yep.
Anything on page? Yeah, so.
This is a good innovation.
Yeah, thank you. I get paid extra for innovations like this.
Yeah, right. And I must say, you know, whoever do the minutes here had done an excellent job.
Okay.
You know, I couldn't even find any typos.
So we try not to correct typos, but right. I'm on page 16.
Yes.
Maybe my pagination isn't the same as yours, but Paula Gerfen is called Paul, and Paul Gerfen is nobody. It's Paula Gerfen. You see that?
I knew that Bob would spot something.
Okay, page 16, 17, 18, 19, and 20. I've got typos here and there, but there's nothing important. Anything else? Up to page 21, 22, 23? 24?
Mm-hmm.
You're doing great.
Yep.
25?
I have one on 25. It's the second full paragraph.
The paragraph that begins?
Yeah, the one that begins finding green.
Yeah.
And the very last sentence, which is that says Dr. Peterson encouraged DCPP to explore the technology options now available in its quest to reassess the need for preventive maintenance. And I think maybe to bold that text, I think I was implying this is also something that we should look at. As a question on fact finding.
So you want to put that
it's
in
covered
bold.
In other places, but I would bold that sentence as something that we're going to be taking action on.
Let's accept that. The things in bold are things that become action for us. Accept that? 26, 7, 8, 9, 30?
Let me ask a question on that last comment. Here, your last phrase there, the last sentence, Dr. Peterson remarked, this effort may have application for PG&E outside the nuclear area. Is that an action item for us to do anything there?
I think so also, again, because I think that would be correct, yeah.
We should encourage them to do something on non-nuclear plants?
Oh, the point being these technologies actually are probably stronger within the non-nuclear sector, and bringing them in to the nuclear application is good, and vice versa. So I think that was the intent. But this is really sort of a general area that I think it's good for us to look at, particularly because PG&E is going to be reducing the amount of preventive maintenance that it performs. And we want to make sure that we're not seeing a reduction in actual plant safety.
That's fair.
Furthermore, preventive maintenance sometimes actually has a negative effect on reliability.
Sure, because maintenance can fail to restore it to its proper.
That's correct. Basically, every time you do maintenance, you leap to the front of the bathtub curve.
Now, I thought Mr. Waddell's point raises a jurisdictional problem for the committee. If it's outside the nuclear arena, why are we asking them to do anything?
I think we don't want to say that that's something that we want DCPP to do, but certainly we would want them to leverage any capabilities that are outside the nuclear area that could be brought back.
We can call their attention to it, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me add, Pierre, that either the November fact finding or you're in my December fact finding, we'll be looking at this very thing.
That's right. And so that'll be good for us.
It's coming up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anything else on pages 26, 7, 8, 9, 30? Okay, on page 31 I have an easy one. At the top, obviously the slides referred to the PCPS, and Bob Rathe, who transcribed it, didn't know what that meant, so I'm telling him it's the Process Control and Protection System, and I'm just going to explain that, okay?
Say it again.
Process Control and Protection System. It's one of the systems in the plant. The abbreviation was used, and in the minutes it just wasn't spelled out, okay? We tried to spell out all the acronyms, and that was one that was missed, okay? Anything, then 31, 32, 33?
At the bottom of 33, there's another acronym.
That's really GSA, and it means the Geological Society of America.
Okay.
And it's GSA, Geological Society of America. Right. I found that one, too, and I'm passing that along.
Okay. You knew what it was. I didn't, what the correct one was.
Yeah, yeah, well, that's a field I work in.
Okay.
Okay. Anything else to the end?
Yes.
Yeah, so I just had, I have typo things and stuff like that, a little stuff that we probably all do.
The top of page 37, last sentence, talked about there have been no transformer flashover events since 2013. That should be insulator flashover. I think we could all agree on that, right?
Yep.
The flashover's on the insulators, not the transformer.
On the top of 37.
Top of 37, last sentence of the first?
Yeah.
Okay.
Anything more? Okay. Hearing none, any member of the public have any comments? And if not, we'll entertain a motion to adopt these minutes as amended.
I have one question on 40.
Which page?
41.
Mm-hmm.
It's the third paragraph down, and it just refers I'd recognized Mr. Ron Alsop. And I believe he's retired. I just can't remember.
No, he will be. He's retiring soon. I saw him this morning.
Okay, so then at that point, definitely still the emergency service manager. I just wanted to confirm that was correct. Yeah.
Rick and I saw him this morning, and he's going to be at the engagement panel tonight, and we'll hear him again.
Good.
Okay.
Are you entertaining a motion, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
I move that the minutes as corrected be adopted.
Can I hear a second?
I will second that.
Ayes?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. So that worked, and I'm going to pass to you my markups.
Thank you. I'll take any others when you have a chance.
I told you were going to be bored. Okay, so the next are action items for the committee. This is on your agenda. Of which the first is the annual report. Just to explain, we're required by our charter to write an annual report, and we write an annual report. And the most recent annual report is for the period from July 1st, 2017, until June 30th, a few months ago. And that 12-month annual report has been under development, led for the committee by Furman Wardell, who's our consultant that pulled that together, and then the members, and we all review it. And Furman, you're up to discuss the annual report.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you look in your rainbow packets, the outline of the report is in the blue pages. Basically, that's the table of contents. Excuse me. So we've had the report under development since August, and the committee has gone through three drafts of the report and put their comments in. Recently, I sent out to the committee the final version, October 22nd version, of the executive summary and conclusions and recommendations for the committee to members to review and see if they were ready to approve the report based on this executive summary. I would note that Per Peterson had two comments or questions on some sections of this executive summary. The first is on page 10. This is not in your rainbow packets, by the way, because it was sent out later. The 10th page, which is the pages aren't numbered in this thing, but it's page 6 under specific conclusions. So if you go to that page that has specific conclusions about halfway down, they're white pages that Rob Wellington just passed out before the meeting. Yeah. And the question Pierre had was on item 1, the third paragraph, which reads, the DCISC will continue to review DCPP's NRC regulatory performance during the next reporting period, paying particular attention to the number and significance of violations in LERs. I'm sorry, it's a paragraph above that. Let me read that one. The committee notes that although the NRC concluded that DCPP operated acceptably, it identified 10 non-cited violations of, quote, very low safety significance, close quote. This is a significant improvement from most previous periods. In Pear's comment, which I'll read, is I think we should discuss whether a reduction in the rate of identification of violations of very low safety significance is a good or bad thing. The other explanation is there is a complacency and less effort is being devoted to finding potential problems. So, Pear, if you'd like to expand on that or tell us what you think.
Thanks, Furman. Yes, the The basic idea here is that when you look at the reporting of problems, it's actually good to see problems being reported at low levels of safety significance. It's also it's very easy for people who are outside of the technology field to see the reporting of problems as being evidence that there are problems rather than evidence that the organization is focused on identifying and correcting problems. And so I think it's a little worrisome to say that reduction in the reporting of problems of minor safety significance is actually a good thing. You might be at risk that it's not. And my recommendation would be to not characterize this as an improvement unless we are confident that this represents an improvement, and maybe just not to put in the sentence at all.
Your suggestion is to delete that sentence.
So, and I want to speak against that. I don't see any evidence that they're slacking off and that this reduction in the number of reported very low safety significance violations is because they're slacking off as opposed to they're getting better. But that is, you know, having looked at that, and we've had fact findings about it and so on, I don't see any evidence of that, but I understand your concern. In fact, let me try to describe it to the members of the public. I want you to pretend that Bob Budnitz was pulled over by a cop once a month for rolling through stop signs and got 12 warnings every year. I'm just pretending. And every time it was a different cop, and every time says, well, you know, you're an old guy. I mean, just behave better next time. I never got a ticket, but I got all these little warnings. And then one year, all of a sudden, there are only three of them. And there are two explanations. Either Bob Budnitz is no longer doing it very much, or the cops aren't paying attention anymore. Okay? I mean, that's an analog to this. And absent any other data, none of you could tell. Right? I mean, you couldn't tell. You need some other data to be able to tell. And Pear's concern here is that if there are much fewer reports of very low safety significance, maybe it's the people are slacking off on reporting them, as opposed to there are really fewer. And from just the fact that there are fewer, you can't tell. You have to have other information. So what's the other information? And my other information, I'm just speaking for me, the others can chime in, is that we haven't seen, haven't seen any changes in the vigilance or the culture or the attention to detail at the station in the last year or two compared to previous, in the fact findings I've been on and the people I've talked to and the data I've looked at. But I'll let others say what they think, because I understand the concern.
I sympathize with Dr. Peterson's sentiment. Maybe it can be rephrased better. Dr. Peterson, how would you say it better?
Well, the first thing is that I would point out that one of the things that you can look at in these sorts of reports is to make sure that there's not some common theme or thread involved.
Fair.
Which your analogy actually is not very good because...
Well, I know.
Clearly, the problem is not getting corrected.
No, but there was a common cause. Okay, go on.
So with that, I do know that there is careful attention paid to confirm that there are not... there's not some type of specific problem where things are being repeated and not corrected. And so I think it is more likely than not that this reduction in number represents a real improvement in the performance of the plant. But I'm concerned that we not sort of endorse it as being a great thing. So I'm not sure how to rephrase the sentence. Because I don't think we want to characterize it as being
okay,
a significant improvement.
I just have two more observations. And I'm not going to dwell on this a lot, but The first is that we're not the only people looking at this. The NRC is looking at it, and they haven't identified important cross-cutting issues that I've seen in this period that would cause me to change my view. Secondly, INPO has looked at it too. You don't see INPO's reports, but we do, and they haven't identified it.
Okay. Maybe what we can do is we can say this appears to be an important improvement, should continue to watch this carefully.
Good for you. I'll accept that. That's an excellent idea.
Or just remove the adjective important. I think if we quantify it, that, you know, we don't have substantial basis to make that observation. It appears to be an improvement.
I have a substantial basis, but you don't have to subscribe to it. But I would accept this appears to be a significant improvement, because that's okay. And then have a comma saying, the next sentence says we want to continue to review it. So we're saying that.
Yeah. But on what basis do we make that substantial improvement or important improvement? Because what basis do we have?
The numbers are lower, and I haven't seen any trends that would tell me that they're slacking off. How's that?
Right. I'm happy with significant if we have appears to be,
all right,
which will moderate it a little bit.
It will.
I would suggest
it motivates why it is that we're going to continue to watch this carefully.
Which we are.
I'm changing the sentence to say this appears to be an improvement for most periods.
That's good.
Is that good?
I accept that.
Okay, good. And the second comment is on the next to the last page.
By the way, I hope the members of the public understand that this is a substantive judgment about which none of us are confident, actually. We're not confident. That's why we keep looking.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
Okay, the second and final comment appears on the last page, the very last paragraph, numbered item 2, and that paragraph reads, the DCISC is interested in continuing to monitor PG&E's ongoing program of working with local, state, and federal agencies to assure adequate emergency preparedness in the event of a significant accident. that's our concern.
Correct.
Pierre, your comment was, I'm not worried about this issue. Item 1 is the only one I think we need to list. Item 1 is the one above it. So.
And the basis there is that I think from everything we've seen, PG&E is being sufficiently proactive in this area. And furthermore, the NRC is also considering these issues around appropriate levels of emergency protection, emergency preparedness as plants move through decommissioning and as the hazards associated with the plant change substantively during that process. And so listing this as a concern is something that I think is perhaps it doesn't rise to that level, particularly compared to the first item that we've listed here. And so it's not that it's not important. I just think that it doesn't rise to the level of being something we should list as a concern.
Yeah, it's going to happen with or without us, the second item. So I would agree we could probably delete that.
And the first one is one that I think genuinely.
Hold on. I'm trying to understand something. I hope you're not saying, because I know you're not saying, that we shouldn't continue to review this. You just don't think it's a concern, as opposed to something we've got to keep looking at.
See, the thing is that concerns, read the definition.
No, I
concerns
understand.
Are items which, while not necessarily warranting recommendations,
need enhanced committee right. So your point is this doesn't need enhanced committee review and scrutiny. It you're saying why pick it out, and I concur in that. In other words, we're going to keep doing this. Rick and I did it this morning. We'll tell you about that later to the public. And so if you think that the fact that we're going to keep doing it, which we are, is sufficient, it's not a concern, I can accept that.
There's no enhancement there, right? No enhancement.
Well, we don't have to enhance it because there's nothing that made us want to enhance what we're already doing quite thoroughly.
I agree.
Right.
I agree.
And so the first one, of course, that we've listed, which relates to the retention of qualified
That's a
staff,
real concern.
That's a real concern, although it has been mitigated some because...
But not enough.
But because of the passage of the Senate bill, which happened since our last public meeting, when we were castigated for creating a situation where it would not get passed, and then it did get passed, which I'm very pleased did happen.
So. Okay, so I can accept that deletion.
Okay.
Okay, well.
All right.
It sounds like we're all agreed, and we'll delete that.
The other thing I should mention is that both of these edits that I'd asked us to review, I think are of moderate importance, and overall the annual report is very well constructed, and a lot of credit go to our consultants, Rick McWhorter and Furman Wardell, Bob Rathy for making that happen. And I'd really like at this point just to publicly recognize that fantastic work in collating and creating this document. It's really the most important product that this committee creates on an annual basis.
All right. Well, that said, I would propose to the members that we consider approving this annual report.
Yeah.
If you do, we will then finalize it and then get it into Rob Wellington's office.
Okay. So I have a comment, and then I'm going to entertain a motion. The comment was about a minute ago. I said, we'll hear more about that later. This topic is going to be on our agenda later during our meeting, which is why we're not going to go into it here. But with that said, we should entertain a motion to accept the annual report, and at which point it will go into our archives and be distributed publicly to the world.
I'm pleased to be able to move that we accept this report.
I second Dr. Peterson's motion.
Any comment from any of us? Any comment from the members of the public?
Okay. I just wanted to comment briefly, Gene Nelson, Californians for Green Nuclear Power, that the fall off of employees, I want to reiterate, it was only people who were training to become reactor operators. No reactor operators, to my knowledge, have been impacted by any proposed changes.
That's a fair comment. Any other comment? Want to call this question?
Yep.
Okay. Aye.
Aye.
Okay, that passed.
Can I ask the committee, relative to reproduction now of the annual report, we prepare a few hard copies that are filed
in the library,
a couple of local libraries and at Cal Poly, and then we've done CD-ROMs as well in the past. Bob has noted to me that a lot of computers and a lot of folks don't have CD-ROM drives in their computers anymore, but have thumb drives. And is there any problem with us putting making up a number of thumb drives for distribution?
Yeah, I think authorizing that is sensible because we want to make it as widely available to members of the public as we can.
Yeah. Okay.
One thought though, it's also available for download from our website.
Correct.
So, given that ultimately ratepayers will pay for those thumb drives, is it sufficient for us to provide a link to where you can download, or do we need to provide it in electronic form also?
We don't distribute very many of the CD-ROMs. On occasion, when you members have had meetings with your appointing authorities, we have left copies.
You make a good point.
And we thought at least thumb drives might be a little more accessible than a CD-ROM.
You mean Jerry Brown's going to be happier with this than with this?
Or his staff might be.
You know, I do have to say that these days, sticking some random person's thumb drive into your computer is considered to be dangerous, too.
The number is tiny, and therefore the a few dollars here and there is a tiny number times a few.
We won't spend very much.
I'm perfectly willing not only to authorize that, but to encourage it, because the more accessible, the better. All right?
Thank you.
Sure. Anything else on? Oh, so we're done with that item. B is update on financial matters, and I'll turn that over to Rob Wellington.
Well, you received the report from our financial folks, and you see that we've operated this last year. Fiscal year and calendar year 2017, well within our $920,000 grant from PG&E and PG&E customers. And we have refunded to PG&E for last year approximately $147,000. This year, our operations are running slightly ahead of last year. And so we will have sufficient funds to finish our operations this year, and probably we'll have some sort of refund of a lesser nature for 2018. That's all I have on the finances.
Any questions from members, consultants? Anybody in the public have a comment about that? That said, we'll accept that report.
Next was activities.
And next is activities.
And you will find those in the rainbow packet that you all have in the green pages. You got several pages that list all of the fact-finding and public meeting agenda items for 2018-2019.
Second set of green pages.
Pardon?
The second set of green pages.
The second set of green pages.
Okay.
Any questions about that? Otherwise, that's my report.
Okay. Hearing none, any comment about that from members? The next is 5C on the agenda. It's the open items list. I always introduce this item myself with a comment that this discussion of the open items list is one of the most important things that we do in these meetings. For members of the public that don't know what it is, through this list, we decide which technical issues are going to be given priority by our committee in the next year, or the next 6 months, or the next period. Certain items are assigned much higher priority and some lower, depending on their safety significance or how recently we've looked at them, or whether there's fast-moving or slow-moving. So I want to just make that preamble, and now we're going to go to the open items list. It is in your books in the things that look like they're goldenrod color. And Furman Wardell can lead us in that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If the rainbow packet's just the golden color pages, we can read sideways. One comment about the open items list before I get started. Items that are new or changed from the previous list are in italics and in red. So those would be items that are changed from the previous list. I'll make one other comment, too, and that is in the right-hand column called Next Action, there's a number of entries that are listed as fourth quarter 18 FF, which are fact findings. Rick McWhorter and I have gone through those, and as I get to those on the list here, we've made tentative assignments to specific fact-finding meetings where these items will be looked at, so I'll cover that as well.
Well, the fourth quarter means November, December. That's all we have left.
That's correct. But we move some of them to the first or second quarter next year, too. Right. Well, let me start on page one. And let me CO11, that will be done at the December 18 fact-finding meeting with Dr. Peterson and me. Same for item CO13. We'll also cover that in December. The last item, CO14, we're moving that to the first quarter of 19. That's not an item that needs to be looked at this year particularly.
Okay, I had a comment on CO10.
CO10.
Which you have suggested should be looked at in the second quarter of next year. And I would be perfectly happy if that was put off to the third or even the fourth quarter of 19. Let's see if others can concur. The mispositioning was looked at in July. I was here. I think that was one that I was on. Anyway, and it was satisfactory, and I don't see that it has to be as urgent as that.
Right. That's the July fact-finding meeting that we had, and we can move that to third quarter because that would help put it after the outage.
Yeah, and I would say third or even fourth. We got to, enough said.
Right.
Because this issue was examined in just April and in July.
July was actually a quality assurance audit of this area.
That's
what that was. All right. How about page two?
And in fact, by the way, next year is a two outage year. Unit two is going to have a longer outage from September to December, so we can put it off till either just before or just after that. We'll worry about that later, okay?
Right.
Next page.
Page two, item CM13. That is to be covered in the November 18 fact-finding meeting, Bob, with you and Rick.
Yep. The November 18 is Rick and me.
That's correct. The EN 31, about halfway down the page, that'll be covered in pairs in my December fact-finding meeting. Mm-hmm. And then HS 6 at the bottom, that's to be covered in this public meeting today or tomorrow.
Now, on EN 31, was there a fact-finding meeting in August?
Yes.
And
yeah, no, it was a year ago. It was a year ago.
Right, and we're doing it in December, so that means we're doing this issue on an annual basis. Wasn't it on a year ago that the finding was satisfactory on EN 31? In August of 2017, I thought the finding was more than satisfactory.
But that finding did call for a more detailed review later. It wasn't totally clean. I don't remember the exact words, but they are summarized here.
The December 18 is really a follow-up to see how the engineering excellence plan has been implemented.
Okay. No? Okay. So that's consistent with the earlier finding then. Okay.
Yeah. Yes. That was our intent.
Other comments on page 2?
Oh, wait up. Yeah. HP 25. This is the management observation program?
Yes.
And if it was delayed a few months, that wouldn't bother me. I thought that what with the outage coming up, that we might want to delay it till April or May. But I'm not hung up about that. I just think that could be delayed without any bothering me.
How about if I say first or second quarter, 19?
That's fine.
Okay, moving to page 3. Item RA6, about a third of the way down. We're going to move that, Bob, on your approval, to the third quarter of 19.
Oh, I was about to tell you that that putting that off until the fourth quarter of 19 would be perfectly happy for me.
Okay, fourth quarter.
And the reason for that is because by about the middle of 19, we're going to get the NRC's review of that. It's expected to come in the summer.
Okay.
But you know, third quarter might be a little tight, so for fourth. And the same thing is true with RA5, which is the non-seismic PRA program. Furman, you and I just reviewed that in September, just a month ago.
Right.
And I don't think that a second quarter 19 is timely. I think that could be put off to the fourth quarter, about a year or more thereafter. And the reason for that is that some of the review that we're going to get of the seismic PRA is going to be relevant to that, even though it says non-seismic. And I would suggest we put both of them off to the fourth quarter 19 and do them together.
I agree.
Okay.
Yep. Thank you.
I have a comment on EP, which is that we may want to add a separate item which relates to the concern that we discussed so that we're tracking the evolution of EP and the future resources and such into decommissioning, because that's not really explicitly identified here under emergency preparedness. Does that make sense? Because it's an important issue for us to be tracking, and we didn't really we listed it as a concern, but we didn't put it in as a specific thing here within our action item list.
So this is emergency preparedness during decommissioning, during and after decommissioning, that sort of thing?
That's right. Essentially, it could almost be the text of the concern, but moved here as something that we're following.
So are you proposing a new item?
Yeah, a new item, which is, because this one really focuses on the sort of the current status.
Annual drills.
But that's an independent question that we have identified that we were going to elevate to be a concern, and therefore we probably should have something listed that we're monitoring that specifically.
In fact, Bob Budnitz and I will be reporting on that. We looked into that at our September fact-finding meeting, and we'll be reporting on that actually tomorrow.
Okay, so I have a report about that, just one sentence here. Rick McWhorter and I spent the morning out at the we went to the plant, and then we went to the emergency center, and then we went to the Joint Information Center. doing a partial observation of the evaluated exercise that's going on right now. It's going on all day today, and we only got to see half of it. And I'm not going to preempt getting in front of it, but it was largely satisfactory. But I want to make sure that EP2 shows that the next one is that the next evaluated exercise we're going to do. Okay?
Yeah.
For sure. Let's not let that go.
Yeah, that's what I mean when I say okay. Next evaluated exercise.
Okay. Sherry Lewis?
Yeah, Sherry Lewis for San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. I have two questions on this page. The first one is EP2, and you have crossed out the last sentence, consider public participation in drills.
Yeah,
apparently you're not considering public participation?
No, we considered it, but it's not possible.
And no comment on that?
It's not possible.
Why?
Because they who run them don't admit public. I mean, it's outside of our control. PG&E and the FEMA and NRC and the state and all the other agencies coordinate this together, and it's not something that, as I said, it's outside our control. It's not something that their procedures allow members of the public to observe.
I assume that the reason for that is they want to avoid what could appear like a circus.
Well, I don't know what to assume. We were out there this morning. There were 10 or a dozen local agencies out there, like the school district and the county supervisors had somebody there, and there was somebody there from the local fire and somebody there from the local police and highway patrol and Cal Fire and a bunch of agents, and the county agricultural people are out there because, of course, you know, if you have an accident, that's a concern. There's plenty of local representation out there, but they represent agencies that would have to be involved if an event required them to respond.
Well, I'm just thinking back of a meeting that we had a long time ago where somebody brought up the idea, you may have things that are going smoothly, but you're not bringing in what's possible of a person being very upset, very excited, causing a lot of problems.
Yeah.
Something like that would show up if you had, you know, actors there, or if you had, I mean, when you do it the way you have it here, it's going to be more controlled and more by the book, more routine the way they do it. But in real life, when something like this happens, you get a lot of screwy things to happen.
I personally say, you bet I agree with you, but an inquiry convinced us that it's not possible within the way those things are run now. If you or a member of the public wants to inquire about that, you should send a letter to PG&E. It's not something we can do. I mean, we don't run them. In fact, you should know, when we're out there, and we were out there, we're not allowed to talk to anybody about anything. We have to just stand next to the wall. If we see something, we'll make a note and send about it later. But when it's going on, we are flies on the wall.
Yeah, you can't interfere at all.
We can't interfere because the dynamic isn't something where an observation, even a corrective observation, would be appropriate.
Right, I understand that.
So we're just passive.
Okay.
By the way,
we're
fortunate
up.
That we're able to do that because we learn.
Well, that's true.
So it's just outside our remit. Okay.
Okay, the other one is RP12, which you haven't got to. I don't know if you're going to.
We haven't got to yet.
Right, but are you going to, or shall I ask my question?
Well, we can do it while you're standing up there.
Okay, good.
Any comment about this?
Me? Yeah. Can we see the reports? The reports of review annual radioactivity release reports. Can we see them?
They're public documents. They're sent to the NRC.
They're public documents.
Okay. Thank you.
If you want to know how to get them, you can ask one of us. We'll or PG&E. Yeah, they're
public documents.
They're public documents in the docket.
You can probably get them off the NRC website.
Or you can ask the inspector who's here.
Gene Nelson with Californians for Green Nuclear Power. I've personally participated in, I think, preparations for these exercises at the JIC, the Joint Information Center. And one of my observations is when that is fully staffed, there is not room, which is probably why you had to stand today. So I just wanted to offer that very important observation. Thank you.
Well, it's fair to say that when we were at the emergency operations facility, and there were more people than seats.
Okay. Moving ahead on page 3. Item QP3, we're moving that to first quarter 19. That's QA audits. We looked at that back in January, and I think another year. We don't need to look at that this year, but I think the next few months we could look at it again. No rush. Other comments on page 3?
No.
Nope. No. Page 4?
What's ER6?
ER6. Well, that's an item I believe Pear added last time, and we're going to look at that in Pear's and my fact-finding meeting in December.
We have several items that relate to this. I think this is also, we want to make sure that we capture that this encompasses preventive maintenance. We don't really capture the question of preventive maintenance since the frequency is being adjusted. That's also something that fits into this category. And my recommendation is we just leave it with this very simple title, because we have a whole set of items, new items, that we'll be following up on. And then we develop a better description of it, but this will be something that we can monitor going forward after this initial fact-finding during the coming quarter.
That's kind of what I was thinking as well.
Perfect. Good. Yeah. Okay. But for now, this is perfect just to list it as a new item.
Good.
Yep. Okay, the next item I have is SE49, about two-thirds of the way down.
Oh, by the way, I want to accept closing 47. That's fine with me.
I'm sorry. Close on SE47. Okay,
yeah,
great.
That's fine. 49 you're talking about.
Right. 49, Pierre, and I'll take a look at that in our December fact-finding meeting. That's the emergency diesel generator status.
Well, Rick and I had it on our agenda for the November, and then they couldn't support it, so you're going to do it in December.
That's correct. Other comments on page 4? Page 5. Go ahead. I was going to do SF3, about two-thirds of the way down in red. And Bob, I'd move that, Rick and I'd move that to third quarter 19. But I guess you might want to do that fourth quarter 19.
Yes, so you see, that one in SC3, we ought to move to the fourth quarter of 19 when we're doing that. It'll be a comprehensive review of all that stuff.
Okay. So SF2.
And that will not be untimely even then.
Right. Let's see. So that's SC3, fourth quarter. And SC12 pair at the bottom, workplace seismic safety. We're looking at that at your May 19 fact-finding.
I think that's fine.
Okay. Other comments on page 5? Page 6, FP5, that'll be looked at the January 19 fact-finding meeting.
Which one?
January 19.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, that'll give us a chance to review the results of the NRC first triennial after the NFPA 805 implementation.
Right.
Do we, because we're going to close FP6, which I concur with, do we want to move some sort of mention of 805 up into FP5 just to make sure that we're sort of checking on how that's going?
Well, it becomes the program now.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I was looking at it.
I don't know if we need to just have a little note on it or not. I know we'll be watching it, so it doesn't matter that much.
Yeah, I'll throw a note in there. I think it's a good idea. But Bob is right. It does become the fire protection system. All right, moving down, LD3. That's not one we look at very frequently. It's the non-licensed training.
Furman, I wrote a note in my own version in handwriting. It says that's overdue.
All right. Well, I've got here the peer, and I'll look at it in December fact finding. How does that sound?
That's great.
Okay.
May I comment on that one?
Yeah, sure.
Sherry Lewis, San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. I'm glad you say that's overdue, because it says here that you want to look at it at, this is, I'm talking about LD3.
Uh-huh.
You're saying you want to look at it at least annually, and the last time was in 2014.
It's been a while.
We plead guilty, but each year we pass it over because we were comfortable, but now we're finally not.
Yes, good.
Okay.
In fact, we spend more time on LD6, which is the licensed operator training, as opposed to the non-licensed technical training. But we're going to cover that LD3 in December.
Good.
DEC1, decommissioning. We're talking about that in this public meeting. And, Bob, I think you and Rick are going to bring that up at the November faculty
Correct.
Meeting.
Correct.
So we've got that there for
November. It'll be on our agenda in November.
And that concludes that page, unless there are other comments.
Could I ask?
Yes, identify yourself.
My name is Alex Carlin. I'm a member of the Diablo Canyon yeah. Decommissioning.
I just say that because people are watching.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for reminding me. I have a question with regard to the decommissioning action items, and this is an interface between your committee and ours, perhaps. As I understand, DEC-3 in particular seems to reflect that the Independent Safety Committee is at this time principally interested in the decommissioning due to the potential impacts during the period of plant operation. And so you're going to seek clarification as to what role, if any, your committee would have during the period of decommissioning or post-shutdown. This seems like a logical thing to do. I have not recently reviewed your charter on this issue, so I don't know what it says exactly, and perhaps you could help us a little bit. Does it specify jurisdiction or responsibilities during operation? Because here's my thought or concern is you all have a lot of strength and technical strength and experience here, and this could be valuable in the decommissioning process. But you don't represent the community or the stakeholders in any way, except, of course, two of you are from California. On the other hand, the decommissioning engagement panel is a citizen volunteer group that is very recently created and may not have the strength, horsepower, or duration that you all have shown over the 28 years you've been here paying attention to these issues. I think there's the best of both worlds somewhere down the line, hopefully. But it is important for us as a decommissioning engagement panel to understand and interface, perhaps, or understand what you're doing, understand what we're doing, so that we can not overlap, if possible, and learn from each other, if possible.
Okay, so you should know that we have an agenda item on tomorrow's agenda.
Right.
In which we are going to talk... Great. Again, because we did it the last time, about what possible role the committee might play after shutdown. And we actually have a specific proposal that we're going to be talking about, but that's for tomorrow.
Great. Well, I will try to be here tomorrow. I will be here tomorrow, and I'm looking forward to hearing from that and Dr. Victor's presentation.
And we're looking forward to tonight's meeting with the panel because
it's an important issue, and we're
going to learn more about...
We can sort this out.
Yeah. Okay. I might add that our last meeting, we put together a matrix of what we should be doing in the various phases of decommissioning and spent fuel movement. We've updated that. I think we'll talk about that tomorrow as well.
Is it true that the charter is currently stated provides for a role during operation and does not provide for a decommissioning role?
We're going to talk about that tomorrow because it's ambiguous.
We think so, but we'll talk about it.
So it's an item on our agenda.
Great.
But I'd say that our charter is not crystal clear. And moreover, with respect to whether there's a role post-operation, if we are focused on operational safety, whatever that means, and we think it's appropriate, I think, that the state agencies that appoint us be asked to weigh in about what they want to have happen. It's not up to us to decide. Yes. It's really up to them.
May I ask, is the charter written by the agencies and the PUC and the settling parties that settled the rate-making case?
No, it was 25 years ago, and then it was restated about a decade ago.
Right. I've seen both of those.
But it's the California Public Utilities Commission who's
written the charter.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Linda Seeley with Mothers for Peace and the Community Engagement or Decommissioning Engagement Panel. Are any of you experts on dry cask storage? Dry cask storage? Are you all? Do you know a lot about dry cask storage? And
quite a bit.
Okay. So we could rely on you maybe because that, you know, transferring out of the pools and into dry cask storage is going to be huge, right?
So we already perform evaluations of the existing dry cask storage.
Because it's been going on for a while.
Those are competencies that the committee needs to maintain. Of course, speculating about who specifically will be on the committee 5 years from now is probably not warranted, but it is something definitely that the committee needs to have competency in.
Right. Okay.
As you may probably aware, I happen to sit on the licensing board that approved this facility, dry cask storage.
Way back.
Right, 27 years ago. But things have changed.
Right.
You know, there are new information coming into focus now that needs further inquiry.
And I have a very strong desire as a member of the decommissioning panel that to make Diablo Canyon an example of the safest dry cask storage that is possible on the face of the planet, because it's not just a problem here, it's a problem all over the world. And so we're talking about repurposing the facility and creating along with Cal Poly or the CSU system and the UC system and creating some kind of a research facility, and I would think that that would be a great place to do research on how to store this substance in the safest way possible ever for
yes,
a long, long time.
Yes, so, indeed.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Right. Moving to page 7 then, top of the page.
Excuse me.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. Gene Nelson, Californians for Green Nuclear Power. I do think it is important to appreciate that the rapidly decaying radioisotopes found in so-called spent nuclear fuel disappear very quickly. It's the long-lived ones that obviously last a long time, but they have a much lower specific activity. And in fact, by about 300 years, I want to make sure you note this, 300 years from now, the radioactivity and that so-called spent nuclear fuel will be comparable to radioactive to the ore that's used when we are extracting for newly purified material.
Thank you.
All right, moving to page 7 then, top of the page.
Nobody
says. DEC-4. Pierre, that was your comment, excuse me. And we're going to cover that in December if you'd like.
Yeah.
Pierre?
Yep.
Question to you about this.
Sorry, I'm.
Page 7, top of the page, DEC-4. Would you want to cover that in December?
Oh, thank you for the.
Yeah.
Correct. Actually, there was also an executive order, and I've not yet had a chance to review it. I'm not so sure if we got it sent around or not, but I think it is worthwhile for us to look at disposition paths for the different wastes that are generated during the decommissioning process.
All right. So we'll do that in December then. Is that good?
Yeah, I think that's good.
The next one, Bob, 01, I've got you and Rick doing.
We're going to do one of those in November, I hope. Right, Rick?
Right.
By the way, there are a zillion different evolutions, so you don't cover them all, but we're going to do one.
Yeah, you'll find one. My next item is a little over half page down. It's February 2018 p.m., number 4. And, Pierre, we'll try to put that in our December fact-finding as well.
Good.
The next one, item 14, we're going to put that off. That's the staffing requirements, NRC required staffing, we're going to do that first quarter of 19.
On number 15, if you put that off, it would be okay to put it off until the first quarter next year.
Number
I'm talking 15. About 15?
First quarter of 19.
And let me tell you why. Well, you know Furman. Furman and I saw Ron Alsop at our faculty in December. There's going to be a report about that later in this meeting.
Correct.
And there's going to be a little more clarity about that by the end of the year or early in 19. So I would put off that one until, say, the first quarter of 19.
Will do.
I have kind of a related question on that. We had purpose to try to get Ron Alsop to present to the committee at this public meeting. Yeah. He could not do it because the emergency exercise was today. Yeah. I had kind of tentatively ported that over to the possible topic list for the February public meeting, but he will have retired, and there's some turnover involved there. Do we still want to try to get a presentation from the county emergency services in February, or seeing that turnover defer it to a later public meeting?
I think it makes sense to defer.
Okay. So at least June time frame.
Yeah, I think what one wants them to have, because that's an important transition, and we'll want to, whoever the new leadership is that comes in will need some time, and then
okay.
I think it's a very good idea for us.
Yeah, just to explain to the public, when the plant shuts down, it is important that the emergency preparedness capability not go to zero. We want to make sure that is so. And yet the risk is lower than when the plant's running. And so there's some middle ground, and we want to make sure that we have reviewed their plans and the county's projection of resources to make sure that it's adequate. Okay? I mean, that's what that's about. And we had a fact finding on that in September, and Furman's going to report about that a little later in this meeting.
Yeah, tomorrow.
And so we'll cover that later.
All right. Thank you, Bob. The last item, number 19, PEER, I've got that for our December fact finding as well. That's the nuclear promise.
Good. Yeah.
So we have a full meeting. Page 8, very top item. That's the emergency services, and we'll
right.
do that in June, I guess, won't we? June
right.
public
that's,
meeting.
That is what we just decided.
That's what you just talked about, right?
Yep.
Yeah,
it's the same thing. I knew it was somewhere else on here.
Right. I'm suggesting we close some of these as indicated.
Yeah, all the ones that are closed are okay with me.
I agree with all the closed ones.
Item 6, about halfway down, the QV assessment. We're going to put that pair in our December fact-finding meeting.
Good.
Okay. On number 3, I would love to see that executive order. I haven't had a chance to review it.
We need to get our hands on that and prepare for the December fact-finding meeting.
Correct.
I'll get that for us.
Thanks.
Number 8, Hector. Hector, number 6 on page 8.
Number 8. Yeah, number 6.
Right. Would you have a status report on that? Do you have that copy there?
I don't have a copy of it, but I could follow up with you.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Good.
Item Good. 7. I've got that into a November fact-finding, Bob, and then probably close it after that.
Which one?
Number 7 there.
Yeah, that's fine.
All right.
Yeah.
Rick, you and I are going to do that.
Yeah, just to review the history on that, we did decide to do a fact-finding. They did it in July, but there was some specific follow-up questions that we are doing in November.
Right.
The last item, 10, while Rick and I put down here, would you want to do that in November?
If you put it on the agenda, I'll do it.
Okay, good.
Right.
It won't take long, I don't think.
Right. Looking at the load-bearing wall between the 4K and DC bus rooms, Hector, and we'll want to add that on our tour for November. I'll get you a note on that.
Perfect. That shouldn't be a problem. Thank you.
All right.
Now, on page 9, which are the last items, I have those all hoping to be closed.
Say that again.
Page 9, all those items.
Yeah, and number 14, I prepared that thing, and we're going to talk about it tomorrow.
Right, and I've got that to be closed since you've already done it. And that concludes the report on the open items list.
I have one more.
Okay.
If you turn to page 10, which has this long list of things we do periodically,
mm-hmm.
on the second column it says margin management, and there's clearly an error because it says next review, second quarter 18.
Yeah.
And
I'll have to look into that.
And I think you've got to go and correct that by going back to the true list and putting what we just did.
Yeah, a good catch. Thank you. I'll check that.
Furman, over on the first column, there's a duplicate item. RCS process control is on there twice.
RCS process control.
What are you talking about?
Oh, yeah.
Different dates.
Process
page 10.
System.
Yeah, which one?
Left-hand column, RCS process control is there once and then again about three lines later. It's got an extra word in it, but it's the same
sentence. I think those are different systems, but let me check that to be sure.
Oh, okay. Well, the only difference in the two.
I know, but I'm not sure. I'll have to check the reports to see what we meant there. Right, okay. Other comments? I think we're done.
Yeah, I just have one more.
Okay.
Okay. And that is in this list of all the things we're supposed to do periodically.
Yeah.
We haven't looked at the steam generators since November 2014.
Yeah,
and that's 4 years. What?
I thought about doing that, but they haven't done any inspections since 14.
Yes. Right. We're coming to the same place.
Okay.
They're going to be doing because remember they replaced them a bunch of years ago.
Right.
They're going to be doing an inspection in the 21s, and we ought to put that on our agenda to look right after they did that.
All right.
In the 21 outages, which are coming up in, there's going to be one in February, March, and one in the fall.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, Rick's right. They haven't done any inspections.
Right. So, but I wanted to be sure that we didn't leave that out.
I'll put it in there, be sure.
That when they do the steam generator inspection, we want to go and look and see what they found.
I'll put it in, be sure we have.
That was the only one I saw that sort of rang a bell.
I think that's covered elsewhere, but I can't find it right away.
All right, good. Other comments?
No?
All right, that concludes the report. Thank you for your help.
Anybody else? Any comment? I'm going to have a break right now for until on the hour. It's now 9 minutes till. And when we come back, the first item on the agenda when we come back will be remarks from Bruce Watson from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission staff.
Almost right on time.
Yeah, almost.
You ready? The next item on our agenda is, and it's a great pleasure to have this item because it came as a surprise that he was available, and he is, and we're here to have him. Bruce Watson is the chief of a branch at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It's the NRC Reactor Decommissioning Branch. And that title of the branch tells a story, Reactor Decommissioning Branch. And as a branch chief, with others working with him, he has an important responsibility for the way NRC regulates and oversees and assures the safety of decommissioning activities. And he's here today to talk about the title is Reactor Decommissioning and also proposed changes to decommissioning regulations, which are out in the public comment and resolution period now. So it's a real pleasure to introduce Bruce Watson. His being here was because he's going to be also tonight at the engagement panel, and we were just pleased that this coincidence made it possible for him to make the presentation to us today. Go ahead, Bruce.
Thank you, Chairman.
and distinguished members of the committee. I have a prepared statement I'm going to read, if it's okay with you.
And you should know, I assume, you're on TV and it's being streamed.
Right,
and
I understand that. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you this afternoon and provide you information on how the NRC accomplishes its mission of safety and security for ensuring the safety commissioning of nuclear power plants, including the management of spent fuel generated by those plants. As you know, the NRC is an independent federal agency established to license and regulate the civilian use of radioactive materials in the United States to ensure adequate protection of public health and safety, promote the common defense and security, and protect the environment. I will discuss the regulatory process for nuclear power plant decommissioning, including our role in the engagement with stakeholders, such as individual citizens, state, local government officials, industry, and non-government organizations. So what is decommissioning? When a power plant or a power company decides to close their nuclear plant permanently, the facility must be decommissioned by safely removing it from service and reducing residual radioactivity to a level that permits release of the property and termination of the operating license. The NRC has strict rules for governing nuclear power plant decommissioning involving the cleanup of radioactively contaminated plant systems and structures and the removal of spent fuel. These requirements protect workers and the public during the entire decommissioning process and the public after the license is terminated. Under the Atomic Energy Act of 1954, as amended, the NRC is authorized to regulate the radiological decommissioning. The cleanup of non-radiological hazardous materials is regulated by the EPA, or Environmental Protection Agency, or a state-authorized agency. Site restoration and reutilization is the responsibility of the property owner and the state to determine. Once the license is terminated, the NRC has no say in what the owner does with the property, has to deal with whatever the state and stakeholders on that. The decommissioning process for nuclear power plants begins with the formal written notification to the NRC by the licensee that the nuclear operations have permanently ceased and that the fuel has been removed from the reactor. These notifications are publicly available, so any individual can remain informed as the decommissioning proceeds. Within 2 years of the shutdown, or the permanent shutdown, the NRC requires licensees to submit a report. It's called the Post-Shutdown Decommissioning Activities Report, or we call it just the PSDER because we like to do lots of acronyms. Post-Shutdown Decommissioning Activities Report. No major decommissioning activities described in the PSDER can begin until 90 days after the agency receives the report and confirms that the licensee has provided the following three elements. Number one, a description and schedule for the planned decommissioning. Number two, an estimate of the expected costs of the decommissioning. And three, an evaluation of the potential environmental impacts of the decommissioning. The NRC reviews the report and may request that the licensee provide supplemental information to ensure it meets our requirements. During our review, the NRC holds a public meeting in the vicinity of the shutdown power plant to receive public comments on the report. There are basically two primary approaches that the licensee can accomplish decommissioning in accordance with our regulations. Immediate dismantlement, or what we call decon, or deferred dismantlement, which we call safe store. And they can go back and forth between the two during the time that the plant is shut down. Licensees make decisions on which of these approaches to pursue, taking into a variety of factors into consideration, including ensuring the plant safety, potential dose to workers, availability of decommissioning funds, access to low-level burial waste sites, potential future uses of the site, and stakeholder input. Decommissioning must be completed within 60 years of the plant ceasing operations. A time beyond that would be considered only one necessary to protect the public health and safety in accordance with NRC regulations. The NRC oversight continues throughout the decommissioning process. The NRC continues to oversee the safety, security, and compliance of activities conducted by the licensee. The goals of the oversight program at the nuclear power plants undergoing decommissioning are determined through direct observation and verification if decommissioning activities are being conducted safely, if the spent nuclear fuel is being stored safely, and if activities at the site are being conducted in accordance with all applicable regulations and commitments. Secondly, there's a determination if the administrative controls that the licensee has put in place are adequate and comply with regulatory requirements. The controls include self-assessment, audits and corrective actions, design controls, safety reviews, maintenance, surveillance, radiation protection, and, of course, effluent controls. And lastly, we're there to identify any significant declining performance trends and verify that the licensee has taken actions to reverse the trends. The principal method for oversight is on-site inspections. So we don't go away when the plant shuts down. This is one of the things we hear from the public. You go away after the plant shuts down. We are there to the very end. These inspections are supplemented by observations of site characterization and before license termination or radiological survey to confirm that the radiation levels have been suitably reduced. At least one NRC resident inspector remains on site during the initial phases of the decommissioning process until the complexity and risk associated with site operations are reduced. Eventually, resident inspectors are no longer necessary on site on a daily basis, and the NRC oversight shifts to specialized inspectors from the regional offices or headquarters. The NRC will continue to adjust the level of oversight to ensure the site remains safe and secure, and in response to the licensee's performance as warranted, our oversight continues until the spent fuel is removed from the site and the license is terminated. For public involvement, the public has several opportunities to participate in the decommissioning process. As previously stated, a public meeting is held in the vicinity of the facility after submittal of the PSDR to the NRC. Another public meeting is held when the NRC receives the license termination plan. An opportunity for hearing is provided prior to issuance of a license amendment approving the plan or any other license amendment request. In addition, when the NRC holds a public meeting with the licensee, members of the public may observe the meeting except when the discussion involves proprietary information, sensitive safeguards, or classified information. For decommissioning funds, before a plant begins operations, the licensee must establish a financial mechanism such as a trust or a guarantee from its parent company to ensure there will be sufficient money to pay for the ultimate decommissioning of the facility. Each nuclear power plant licensee must report to the NRC every 2 years the status of its decommissioning funding for each reactor and share of a reactor that it owns. The report must estimate the minimal amount needed for decommissioning by using the formulas found in the NRC regulations. Although there are many factors that affect the reactor decommissioning costs, generally they range from $280 million to $612 million. Now, I'm talking about the radiological decommissioning only, because that's all we're authorized to regulate. The staff performs an independent analysis of these reports to determine whether licensees are providing reasonable decommissioning funding assurance for radiological decommissioning of the reactor at the permanent termination of operation. The latest decommissioning funding status report to the NRC for Diablo Canyon Generating Stations 1 and 2 was submitted by Pacific Gas and Electric in March 2012, and it's publicly available on the NRC website. At the end of 2016, the information in that report is that Diablo Canyon Unit 1 has $1.2 billion. And the Diablo Canyon Unit 2 has $1.5 billion. So that's more than reasonable that they have sufficient funding to complete the decommissioning, radiological decommissioning.
Are those numbers, the 1.2 and 1.5, for the radiological or for the whole job?
It could be for the whole job, but
Okay.
It seems like...
Thank you.
Some utilities differentiate, some don't.
Thank you.
Now, would you, Mr. Watson, would you clarify what the NRC requirement for radiological decontamination? Are you saying if the licensee had put aside exactly that amount, which is in the hundreds of millions of dollar range, mm-hmm. then the agency would not impose any further financial requirement?
That's true.
But knowing, fully knowing, that's grossly insufficient.
No, it's not insufficient for the NRC.
They have 60 years to complete the decommissioning. If their plan has a minimum amount, they still have to justify that amount based on completing the decommissioning in 60 years. So the growth mm-hmm. of the money will be taken into account.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you count on the growth of the money?
Right. So
The
NRC formulas are minimal amounts, but they still have to justify it. That it's reasonable, the amount they
because do. If the licensee really want to save some money and go with your estimate, then they only put aside several hundred millions of dollars. Then to everybody's surprise, there's no way they could have done the job as expeditiously as everybody was expecting to do.
Yeah, but you have to take into account they have 60 years to complete the decommissioning. And if that's their plan, they may base that amount that they put away based on the growth of that money over time. So, you know, most utilities are well funded. Some are not as well funded as others, but they justify to us every other year while they're operating that they have sufficient funds to reasonably complete the radiological decommissioning. And we have the financial people that look at this every year.
So your demand, you know, from a federal agency is really reasonable. Your demand of that funding is more than reasonable.
Right. Keep in mind that the NRC regulates safety. We do not regulate commerce. We do not regulate the collection of those funds for the decommissioning fund. The state's public utility commissions do. That's their responsibility to give the utility or the licensee the ability to collect those funds to put into that fund. And so those are discussions between them on how much they really think they need based on what they believe their schedule is going to be in their approach to decommissioning.
I hear you loud and clear. Yes, indeed.
So
could I follow up on that question, just a slightly different tangent on mm-hmm. it? I know Maine Yankee, I think, completed decommissioning very efficiently, and they're... Actually, I'd be curious to learn more about that one as well. But overall, a very good performance, and they met cost targets, I believe. Mm-hmm. It's well known that anything you try to do in California is expensive. For just a wide variety of reasons, we're a very special state, and so things. Doing anything that you could do anyplace else here generally costs a lot more. But how does one factor that into the NRC requirement for the amount of funding to have?
Well, I would not factor that into the NRC funding. I would factor that into
PG&E's funding, but the amount that PG&E is required to have.
San Onofre right now is waiting on a permit to start decommissioning.
Correct, yes. Like
and
I said,
so they're being delayed by the state not issuing the permit.
Correct, and that increases the cost of decommissioning because if you can't execute the work on schedule, you're still paying for all the staff that are twiddling their thumbs and other things. And so schedule delays and other things like that escalate mm-hmm. costs. And so it raises the question in California, is it feasible to decommission a nuclear plant for any sort of reasonable amount of money?
Right. My comment to that is that the utilities in any state know the process that they would have to follow in their state in order to accomplish the goal.
Okay.
And so I would hope that they would know their business better than the NRC and go to the state utility commission or public utility commission and make sure they have adequate funding. So that would be their business, but...
But you explained to us, I'm not complaining, just reiterating, that the NRC's regulatory authority is the radiological decommissioning. Mm-hmm. All other decommissioning activities, including hazardous ones, are other federal agencies. It could be occupational safety or else they're the state or local jurisdictions.
During our inspection process, we do observe industrial safety for performance.
I bet you do.
And we have a memorandum of agreement with the Department of Labor, to OSHA, that we can report, we can request them to come in and do specific inspections when they want.
Yeah, I understood that, but your authority extends to what I said.
Yeah.
I mean, that's fine.
But again, the decommissioning must take into account the other things that other hazards they're going to run into. The classic example is asbestos abatement. In the older plants, all the pipes are insulated with asbestos. So in order to dismantle them, you have to do the asbestos abatement first, right?
And that's a big deal.
And that's a lot of money. So they have to account for that in their estimate that first they got to do this, okay?
Sure.
I think the nuclear power plants in general do a fairly good job, or a very good job, actually, of keeping as many hazardous materials out of the facilities as they can, and also keeping good control over chemicals and other things that would create a mixed waste type hazard. So I think they've done a pretty good job with that. That kind of type of regulation or information came out back in, I think, the 1980s.
Yep.
So they've been on top of that pretty well.
Right.
I have a closing remark here, and then we can go to questions if you'd like.
Go ahead.
In closing, I welcome your interest in our performance as our important regulatory mission as it pertains to decommissioning a nuclear power plant. I've included the slides I'm using tonight. They're supposedly in your briefing packages, I assume, today. I'm going to be talking extensively about the decommissioning process and also the proposed rules that are currently with the commission. So I think the presentation will describe our extensive decommissioning experience. We have proven regulations. We have a proven inspection program. And with the rulemaking in progress to make the transitioning of these nuclear power plants from operations to decommissioning, it'll make it more efficient. And actually, I think it saves both resources for the utility and for us, for the NRC, and not having to process amendments and exemptions. And so we think that the whole rulemaking process that's going on right now will make make it very much more efficient for everybody, which also protects the decommissioning fund, because they're not spending money doing amendments and other licensing activities that should be automatic. So with that, I thank you for your time, for me to be here, and we'll try to answer any of your questions.
Well, yes, Mr. Watson. So are you saying tonight's presentation to the engagement panel would be more would be different than what you just
absolutely
talk to us, and be more in more details, be longer, for an hour maybe?
Yep.
And we're going to be there to take that in.
That's what I heard.
So so I have a question. I'm sure we do here, and then we'll ask the public if they have any. But my question is, I have two different questions. The first is just a broad question about changes to the decommission regulations that are now under consideration. The word "under consideration," by the way, to members of the public that don't know what that means, is it's a proposed rule, and until it goes through the Administrative Procedures Act, there's a number of steps, public comment and the like, it's nothing more than a proposed rule. Can you tell us, quite separate from the administrative and efficiency aspects of it, whether there's any substantive changes in, for example, the levels of protection that the NRC is seeking or requires?
Well, as I mentioned, it is a proposed rule. It's with the commission. The commission can change anything.
Of course.
So, right now, the proposed rules are fair. It covers a broad spectrum of issues.
Yes, I know.
Okay. There may be minor changes, but it's some wording changes to make it more easier to go into specific, make changes when you go into decommissioning based on risk and health and safety. But the proposed rules are really, in many cases, they're just going to be changes to the guidance. I don't think we're actually proposing many rule changes. I think a lot of it is that we could explain things a little bit better in guidance. Not knowing exactly how the commission is going to make that determination.
I wasn't asking you to speculate on that.
I'm just saying that it is many of the proposed changes are just changes to guidance.
All right, so I want to make it specific. I may have a specific question. Let me stipulate for the moment what we don't know. Let's stipulate that what's before the commission, the latest, gets adopted, literally, just no change.
Right.
And I'm wondering whether you could comment on whether that, as it comes about, were it to come about, including changes not only to the regulations but to regulatory guidance and the like, represents any change in the level of protection that the current regulations are intended to accomplish.
Absolutely no change. There's no safety significance or real issues in this rulemaking. It's primarily administrative to make it easier.
I wasn't arguing the case. I wanted to hear you say that.
No, I understand. I understand that. There is no substantive safety issues in the rulemaking itself, because what we're doing is we're adjusting the rules to adjust the rules so that they actually reflect what we're doing in licensing and exemption space. That are there's like 20 some requests that a licensee would do submit to us for changes. When these rules go into effect, those requests for those changes will be based on certain plant conditions. So there'll be changes in the emergency plans that are allowed based on the amount of time that the fuel's been in the pool, the actual heat load of that fuel, when the fuel is moved to the dry storage. The emergency plan changes significantly with each one of those steps. That is going to be codified as opposed to requesting a license amendment or an exemption to have that happen. So that's the efficiency, but the safety aspects remain the same, because we would not approve the license amendment or exemption unless it was safe to do that. So
there will be a no safety significance consideration provided in the rulemaking, right?
I would assume so, yeah.
That's
not, the rulemaking is not my
not
strength.
Not arguing about the details, but your intent, and you're reflecting what you believe to be the overall agency intent, is that it's not a safety change, it's a change in how safety is to be accomplished.
Right.
Okay, that's important to hear. So then I have a second question. In my mind, there are sort of three phases, and the third phase goes on for a long time. The first phase is the plant shuts down and decommissioning starts while the spent fuel that's in the pools is still in the pools or is gradually being transferred to the casks. That's a certain phase.
Right.
Then on a certain day, it's all in the casks. But decommissioning is still going on. It will not have been completed at any of our sites before then, generally, because the time scale is longer. And that goes on for some years. And then finally, decommissioning ends, and it's all in the cask, but decommissioning ends. And that's the third phase. And the NRC is concerned with all three of those phases. That is, even the third phase, in which it's all in the casks and there's nothing else on the site, it's all been done.
In the slides tonight, I have a slide that addresses each one of those issues.
Yeah, I understand.
From the AEP part, specifically. Yeah, so, yes, your presumption is, or your statement is basically true. You have a plant that shuts down, it's defueled. The fuel has to be in the spent fuel pool for, I think it's
anyway.
16 months or something before it'll reach that point where you can no longer have a Zerk fire. And then at that point, you can downgrade the emergency response off-site organization, because you can't have a credible accident that would cause an off-site dose that it would exceed any EPA protective action guides. And then, of course, when the fuel is eventually moved to the dry storage, the risk is even lower. And so in the end, all the way to the end when the license is still there, going to be terminated, you basically have an emergency plan that addresses what we call an all-hazards emergency plan. Mm-hmm. So you still have the potential for fires. You still have the potential for
tornadoes.
Natural events. Earthquakes around here and other things. So you have an emergency plan that takes that into account. So personal injury, hopefully no one gets hurt. But those types of emergency plans or parts of the emergency plans are still in effect.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. What about, Mr. Watson, what about security?
The rulemaking also addresses the step down of security as the fuels move to the pad. It's completely in the pad. Actually, the nuclear security moves with that, as opposed to needing to do all the controls when the fuel is in the pool. So it'll addresses those changes also, so they become not a requirement to submit a change to the security plan,
per se, or amend the license in any way to get those things affected. I'm sure they will be providing us with revised security plans, let me restate that, that reflect what they are going to be doing with respect to the changes in the security.
So I just have one more question, and I'll ask the others. In this intermediate period, there's a time in which all of the spent fuel is now in the spent fuel casks. But decommissioning is still going on, you know, the rest of the stuff. The NRC's concern at that time, besides the cask, the radiological concern would principally be the radiological risk to the workers under Part 20. In other words, you're concerned that the workers don't get radiological exposures and doses above your limits until the final radiological decommissioning is over.
Two of the major functions in dismantling, I call it dismantling phase, making sure that the plant is dismantled safely, it's protective of the workers, they continue to practice an ALARA program to reduce doses.
Yeah.
We also are ensuring that the waste gets packaged properly because we don't want any releases to the environment. And, of course, maintaining the environmental program until it's no longer needed when all the radioactive material is removed. So
okay.
We continue to do a lot of the same programs that are done during operations until the license is terminated. So it sounds like we do a lot of different things. No. Our principal inspectors in that dismantling phase are health physicists, health physics inspectors. Our principal core competencies, I guess I'll call, of our inspectors during that phase of the decommissioning process. So, and you'll see tonight, our regulations for the decommissioning rules went into effect in 1997. We've got over 20 years of experience with them. The same level of experience with our inspection program. We continue to make a couple improvements on it. We've done some lessons learned, improved some inspection procedures. But we have terminated over 80 licenses since 1997 under those rules. And that includes 10 nuclear power plants. So Maine Yankee, Connecticut Yankee, there's a lot of experience in
the
NRC.
We know.
Humboldt Bay, yeah, I know you guys know, but I'm not sure the audience knows that. We just terminated three complex sites this past year. One was a fuel facility, Hematite in Missouri. We just did the Department of Agriculture Beltsville project, which had buried material. And I guess it's our 17th or 18th research reactor license we've terminated this past year at the State University of New York at Buffalo. So we've got significant amount of decommissioning experience, and so we believe we are prepared to handle just about all the decommissioning work.
Any other questions from our panel or the consultants? Rick?
I fear the cost discussion earlier may have left some questions hanging in the air. I see a nod in the audience, so let me see if I can clarify that I've got this correct in describing the process. Each licensee has to submit to the NRC periodically the decommissioning funding reports, which are reviewed. Those reports contain the information on how much funding they've accrued to prepare, but they also contain estimates of the cost for decommissioning that are site-specific. Is that
not, or is, not really.
Okay. Could you explain that a little bit more?
While the plan is operating, they are required to submit to us every 2 years a cost estimate and how that proved to us they have a reasonable amount of money to decommission the facility. So they do that. The site-specific requirement comes in 5 years before the planned permanent cessation of operation. That's when they're going to submit to us a site-specific decommissioning cost estimate. It will also be in the post-shutdown decommissioning activities report. It'll be updated whenever they decide to submit that. And that is site-specific. And so based on that, is coincides with a schedule and activities they plan to do during the decommissioning. And so our financial people will do a comparison to make sure that it's reasonable and they have sufficient money to finish the project and complete the license termination.
Okay, so in Doble Canyon's case, they'll be coming up on that 5-year point fairly quickly,
right.
And that site-specific cost estimate that Dr. Peterson was asking now, adjusting for the state of California.
Right.
The cost of doing business should be vetted out at that point, if it's not already.
Know how to do business better than we do in California. Secondly, I was going to make a second statement here that when they go into decommissioning, they have to submit that decommissioning funding report every year.
Yeah.
And so we are keeping track of it every year as we observe what's done at the site, how much money is spent, and then how much is left over to continue the decommissioning. So it's an annual event that we go through to make sure that they're remaining, have sufficient money to complete the decommissioning. So far in California, we haven't, actually, all the plants that have decommissioned, we haven't had funding issues.
You have or have not, sorry.
Have not.
Have not.
There's some questions on some of the ones coming up, but we've never had any plant not meet its financial commitment, the licensee, to complete the decommissioning.
Thank you.
Well, to go back to our funding discussion, Mr. Watson, you know, you indicated the licensee is 60 years to complete, and by that time, the money will grow. Now, knowing the money is in a trust fund in escrow, the only permissible investment would be United States Treasury, 10-year Treasury.
It's not the only, but go ahead.
Well, you know, nobody else will allow you to invest anywhere else because it's not liquid, it's not guaranteed. And knowing U.S. Treasury, 10 years, is the yield just broke
3%. I think they're allowed, the trustee is allowed to use a number of investment, I'll say instruments is a term they would use.
That's right.
And so they have to make sure that they're getting a minimum of 2% above inflation.
Right.
Return
but,
on that,
but,
that
but
money.
But to me, you know, counting on money grow in the 60 years doesn't advance the licensee's agenda. You know, I think they would you know, they should do it as expeditiously as feasible. And that would serve everybody's interest. You know, dragging it on for 60 years doesn't make sense.
It's what the commission
Right. Rule. It is permissible, right.
Yeah.
Peter, you may not think it makes sense, but the rules specifically allow up to 60 years, provided the plans are all in place and the money is cared for. Am I correct?
Right.
I think the question's moot. PG&E has made it very clear they want to proceed immediately into decommissioning. So I'm not sure we really need to worry about that question. And the other part is that California ratepayers will end up funding it, and that will be a small fraction of the total cost of electricity in California. So I don't think we need to worry about the financial capabilities or the intentions to move immediately into decommissioning. Both of those seem to be just fine.
Yeah, like I said, they have over $1 billion per plant, which is generally a good amount of money.
Yeah. Okay, so we have a limited time for public comments. If anybody has anything to ask, go right ahead. I said we're going to try to not dwell on this a lot of time. We're coming back to it anyway, but go ahead.
Okay, this is Gene Nelson, California Institute of Green Nuclear Power. First, a point for clarification. The decommissioning funds are collected by the utility with a rate specified by the Utilities Commission. They're already collected. They're part of their cost of getting power from a nuclear power plant. And on the issue of regulation, a group of scientists and engineers, myself included, have criticized in official filings to the NRC, their reliance on a scheme called LNT, Linear No Threshold, that does not have a rigorous scientific basis. A summary is found in Dr. James Conco's recent Forbes article titled regarding ALERA, a $1 trillion waste of resources. So this is something that I think that the committee and the industry will be confronting in the future, is this whole issue of reliance on LNT.
Thank you.
Hello again. This is Alex Carlin with the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel. I'm very glad that Bruce Watson is here. I come from Washington, D.C. for your group and for ours. I have one clarification, and I think Bruce will agree with me. There might have been a confusion there about the status of the quote, proposed rule making. And this is sort of a legalistic point that could escape the layman or whatever, but you'll appreciate it, I think, which is that the agency, the NRC, has been working on these rule changes for a number of years, and they have been in a the proposed rule hasn't been proposed yet. This is a proposed rule, which is to say that apparently about May of this year, Bruce's group and others who had worked very hard over numerous years and had received public input put together a package to the commissioner saying, we would urge you to bless this so they can go out and be proposed.
Right.
So it's not proposed yet.
Thank you.
And when it is proposed, everyone will have an opportunity to comment pro and con about it. And then the agency, as I understand it, plans hopes to get the final rule out by the end of next of 2019. So it's not a proposed rule yet. It will be proposed, let us hope, in the next few months.
Thank
and we
you.
All are watching for it.
Sherry Lewis, San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. I have a couple of questions. Were you saying that Unit 1 and Unit 2, Unit 1 has to have 1.2, or it will cost $1.2 billion?
No, Eugene, he said that's how much money is available. It's not how much it'll cost.
How much money is in the trust?
Okay. And so that's already available?
Yes, yes.
And it may cost a whole lot more than that?
Nobody said that. Nobody has said anything in this room about what it'll really cost.
Okay,
we haven't heard that yet.
Right. So that's one thing. The other question I have is, you say the money will grow within, you know, in 60 years. I'm wondering, if you're using the money up, then it's not going to be growing.
Well, there's a whole regulatory scheme about how that investment is supposed to grow. He could probably describe it in detail or send it to you.
I just want to.
The key point is PG&E plans to move immediately into the decommissioning activities. They're not going to delay.
We're not talking about it.
So we don't. That concern is just not applicable because they're going to start immediately.
One last thing. What if PG&E goes bankrupt? What then?
They did once.
They what?
They were bankrupt once about 10 years ago.
They did go bankrupt.
Well, what if they do it again?
The fund has been set aside.
Yeah, the fund.
The fund is protected.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
It was protected the last time they went bankrupt, so the next time it's going to be fine.
Linda Seeley with the decommissioning panel. Quick question. I don't understand about the rulemaking. You don't have actually a set of rules on decommissioning yet, right? And you do. Oh, this is only changes. So you have a big pile of.
They have regulations and they have regulatory guides that interpret them or help people meet them.
And those are separate from. Mm-hmm. Operating plans.
Yes, the rules for decommissioning are rules for decommissioning.
Okay. I don't know why, but when you came to the meeting before, I was under the impression that there weren't any rules yet and that they had to ask for license amendments in order to go through decommissioning.
That's an incorrect impression.
Okay, I'm very sorry about that, and that makes me feel better. And then you also said that they could switch back and forth between Decon and SafeStore. Can PG&E do that? Okay.
And I'll give you an example.
Okay.
Yes. They have to complete decommissioning in 60 years. It's the utility's plan on how they're going to do that. Yes, and they can start out doing decommissioning and decide that they don't want to do it for a few years and let the fund grow again. So they lay off all the workers and let the fund start to grow.
Or they can decommission part of it.
They can do partial decommissioning and stop. An example of that is Fermi Unit 1 up in near Detroit. It's an old sodium-cooled plant. It really didn't have a decommissioning fund because it was built way before all the regulations went into effect, but Detroit Edison is funding the decommissioning, and they have put aside so much money. And basically, the plant is probably about 90% decommissioned now. They stopped because they want the money to grow. They don't want to have to keep contributing money to the fund during that period. So they've done almost all the decommissioning. They just haven't done the final removal of a number of pipes and a couple low-level waste tanks that are inside buildings. It's perfectly safe, so it's in safe store. And they're going to conclude the decommissioning when they decide they're going to do it well in advance of the 60 years. However, some of the major steps have already been taken. The spent fuel pool has been decommissioned and is gone. The reactor has actually been decommissioned and gone. And so it's really a lot of buildings with very small amounts of radioactivity in it, and it's contained in these concrete buildings, and so it's perfectly safe. That's an example of going back and forth. And
thank you.
They've done that throughout their decommissioning life of Fermi Unit 1. So.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I want to ask if any further. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, good afternoon. David Weissman, Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. And our comment here directed at the NRC's role as an oversight agency is this. If anything, California should learn that past can be and often is prologue. And I look as an analogy to our good neighbors to the south at San Onofre. Because one of the comments Dr. David Victor, who will be speaking with you tomorrow, has made is that one of the number one public concerns at the meetings of the San Onofre decommissioning engagement panel is the lack of trust in the oversight of the regulators. That's apparently one of his top three common themes there. And I would have to say that there's probably good reason for that. It should be remembered that in the San Onofre steam generator fiasco, only recently concluded with a final solution to that, with the work of advocates and ratepayers that brought several $800 million practically of ratepayer money back for a series of escapades for which both San Onofre, the manufacturer Mitsubishi, and to an extent the regulator, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, all led into a five-year-long debacle. When the San Onofre steam generators were replaced, Senators Boxer and Feinstein sent a letter to the NRC saying, you know, this utility has had a sketchy history, and we're a little concerned about them undertaking this in-house operation. And the NRC sent a letter back to the senator saying, absolutely nothing to worry about. We're putting special oversight and inspection on that. And yet we ended up with non-functioning or malfunctioning steam generators that led to the premature closure of the plant, that led to, well, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in ratepayers having to pick up the tab. So the pattern becomes, if the NRC fails to regulate, even though that may be out of our preemptive control and jurisdiction, it is the deep pockets Dr. Peterson referred to earlier, which would be mine, who eventually have to pay for any negligence or oversight on the part of the regulator. Now, this comes to San Onofre just recently. As you may have seen the story in the paper some months ago about the canister cask loading campaign that led to the one cask getting stuck on a small metal lip that caused a potential problem. I won't discuss any of the science behind that, how bad it could have been. The fact was it happened, and it led to a shutdown and a cancellation or a hold on the cask loading campaign. However many days that is, and how much gets held up, and how much protocols and procedures need to be rewritten, that extends, as Dr. Peterson mentioned, the schedule, which we, the ratepayers, will eventually end up paying for. Where the NRC comes into play, and why I think the concerns voiced to Dr. Victor at those meetings has some merit, are that the incident happened on August 3rd, reported on the 6th of this last summer. But 2 days later, on August 8th, a telephonic exit meeting was conducted with the plant manager at San Onofre and the NRC. That was the end of a year-long NRC inspection on their cask loading and procedure. And if one reads the letter, it finds that within these areas, the inspection consisted of selected examination of procedures and representative records, observation activities, and interviews with personnel. The inspection determined you had completed all required activities identified in the Holtec Certificate of Compliance for use of the Holtec High Storm Storage System at your site. One small finding was found related to design control of field changes made to important safety equipment associated with your loading activities Because the violation is of a low safety significance and the licensee initiated a conditional report with appropriate resolution to address this, the violation is being treated as a non-cited violation. Mind you, this letter saying, we've watched you for a year, we think you're doing it all right, is happening 2 days after they finally reported a procedural mishap, which they are now treating, and to which Edison generally concurs, was actually a more serious and, as their own representative says, unacceptable situation. So the public might say, now wait a minute, you spent a year looking over their shoulders, and literally while you were still about to shake their hands and say, good job, this was happening. So now they have to go back, and obviously they have to reevaluate the procedures, and there's going to be a cost to that and a cost to the training of the employees, and that's our bottom line as ratepayers, is the NRC's failure of oversight somehow ends up costing Californians, even if we're preempted from having much to say about it. And I think that bears keeping in mind as PG&E goes ahead and begins to enter this same thing, that there is verifiable reason to believe the suspicions of those who think the regulation may not be as robust as is claimed, and its failure has, in the case of the San Onofre steam generators, catastrophic 7-8-digit figure consequences to ratepayers of California. So keep that in mind is my only thought. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other comment? And hearing none, I think it's opportune at the moment to, unless you have something else to say, Mr. Watson, it's opportune to...
Thank you for doing that.
...to call this session to a close after your review.
I guess with respect to spent fuel management, the utility will get reimbursed from the Department of Energy, so it's not necessarily going to come directly from the pockets of the California ratepayers.
But it's
unfortunately, everyone will have a share in that.
I'm a taxpayer.
Yeah, so I know. I'm saying everyone will have a share in that. So unfortunately, that's the situation we're in. And, you know, trust is earned and built. And so any individual mishap, you can attack the trust thing right away. In any forum. So, well, thank you very much.
And thank you for taking the time. And I want to remind people that Mr. Watson's got a presentation this evening before the community panel. The next item on our agenda is 7A on your agenda. It's we have a brief presentation about public outreach, and then we're going to schedule our future fact findings and public meetings. This should be a short item, but it's certainly not 3 minutes. This would be about 10. Go ahead, Rob Wellington. Just a short.
Yes, the public outreach items. We've already referred to those. So if you look at the second set of green pages, it lists all of the upcoming public meetings and fact findings. We have our next. Our next public meeting is presently scheduled for February 13 and 14. I think we're going to talk about shortly changing that date by a week, I guess. We should try to do that now. And then our subsequent public meetings next year are June 5, 6, and October 23 and 24. That's all I have.
Okay, thank you. The next item on our agenda is, and we do this at each public meeting, we go over the schedule of our fact findings and public meetings over the next year to confirm what we already tentatively planned and to change what we need to change. And so that's before us just now. If those of you that want to find the current schedule, it's in the second set of green pages in the rainbow package, which some of you have. Okay? We're about to come. We have a public meeting scheduled in February that we have to change the date, and we're going to find a date right here. Okay? So we can start. Hold on, I've got to find it. I got it. We're going to start, and I'm just going to read what I think are the agreed on fact findings that for which nothing has changed, and that is November 7th and 8th. We have a fact finding with me and Rick McWhorter. December 12th and 13th, Per Peterson and Furman Wardell have a fact finding. January 23rd and 24th, that's 3 months hence, Peter Lamb and Rick McWhorter. And those have been on our schedule for a long time, and we're just mentioning them because there's without objection we're going to stick to them. They should be right on your sheet here.
But the December dates, I'm just checking my calendar, and I have the 5th and the 6th. I think maybe we changed that.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, so the December date should be the 5th and the 6th.
Okay, I missed that, and I'm glad that's why we're saying this, so as we all hear it at the same time.
It just
time.
Gave me a little bit of excitement because the 12th and the 13th, I'll be in Washington.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So December 5th and 6th is the one, and that's the one you're doing with Furman. Now, the one at issue is the we scheduled a while back a public meeting on February 13th and 14th. And it turns out that we have between us conflicts not only that week, but the week before and the week after. So I want to propose that we hold that public meeting either 2 weeks after, which would be in the week of the 18th to the 21st of February, or 2 weeks before, which is the week between the 28th of January and the 1st of February.
I thought the week before was clear.
Which week?
6-7. The week before. Six and seventh.
Yes, but Peter Lamb can't make that week, it turns out. Oh. Am I right, Peter?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
So Peter Lamb can't make the week 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. I can't make the week that we're in, 11 through 15. And Per Peterson can't make the week of 18 through 22. Am I right? Per?
That's correct. So we looks like
no,
our
no,
options.
No. Am I right?
Yes.
So I'm sorry. So we're talking about either the week of the 25th of February that goes to the 1st of March or the week of the 28th of January that goes to the 1st of February.
Just pointing out the week of 28th of January is the week following the January fact-finding meeting.
Yes, I noticed that.
That would be a little difficult to get that report.
No, I'm not complaining.
You can do a lot, but maybe probably not that.
I'm not complaining. I'm just noticing, and we have to be cognizant of that.
I am thinking the week of February 25th may work.
Huh? It's okay for me.
Okay, so I'm going to do a survey right here. Is there anybody at the table that has trouble with the week of the February 25th until March 1 and will probably do either Tuesday, Wednesday, or Wednesday, Thursday, which would be February 26, 7, or February 27 and 8?
Now, that's contingent on PG&E can accommodate.
Right. So,
contingent on we at the hotel.
Yeah, so okay. We have two issues. One is the hotel, but the second is we need to ask Hector Garcia, who's sitting, 5 meters to my left, to ask whether, and you don't have to respond in 10 seconds because you have to check, whether there's any issue with those, and we have the option of Tuesday, Wednesday, or Wednesday, Thursday, and if one or another of those is better, or you'll tell us, we'll tentatively be talking about scheduling the public meeting for that week, which is a couple weeks later than where we had previously been scheduling, okay?
Yeah, looking at the calendar, 25th, 26th, or 26th, 27th, we don't see a problem. It was originally going to be scheduled during the outage, and that's still in the outage. So.
Well, it was originally going to be just as the outage was starting, and now it's going to be like 2 weeks into the outage.
That's correct.
In some ways, that may be preferable, I assume.
It's preferable on a couple things. I'm going to be performing something at the beginning of the outage, so this will work for me as well.
Okay, so just to ask a question. Is there anybody at the table that has a preference between Tuesday, Wednesday, and Wednesday, Thursday?
Generally, we do Wednesday, Thursday because the public tour works better.
I wasn't complaining, just asking.
Okay, I agree with that.
All right. In which case, we're tentatively going to be talking about Wednesday, the 27th of February, and Thursday, the 28th of February. Okay, now I want to let that be tentative because I want to give Hector Garcia a chance to at least check to see there isn't something that you might not know about that we would need to know about.
Perfect, thank you. I'll get back to you on the 27th and 28th.
And of course, the option of moving in a day or something is present.
That's correct.
So that solves that problem.
Can we check with the hotel the next day as well? Okay.
Okay, thank you. Now, I'm just going to continue reading because I've got it in front of me. The next fact-finding is March 18 and 19. And
That's a Monday, Tuesday.
Yes, and I noticed that's a Monday, Tuesday, and I want to ask the question, and that's Furman, you and me. And I'm not complaining about that. I'm just observing.
Yep.
You want to stick with that? Is Monday not as good for you? Or
I'm curious why we pick Monday, Tuesday.
I don't know, but that's what's on here.
Yeah, same here.
You want to...
If it needs to be, then I can make it. If not...
It doesn't need to be if it could be Tuesday, Wednesday.
Let's try Tuesday, Wednesday.
But if it's Tuesday, Wednesday, I really got to get home by about 6 o'clock. I can't be here in that evening, okay?
Maybe that's why we scheduled it for Monday, mm-hmm. Tuesday. Maybe that's why we scheduled it earlier. We can leave it 18-19.
All right, so let's leave. You want to leave it 18-19? That'd help me.
Sure.
Okay, and then the next one is April 17th and 18th, and that's Lamb and McWhorter. The next one is May 8th and 9th, Peterson and Wardell. The next is the public meeting, and that's scheduled for June 5 and 6. And I assume that that's still okay. And I'm just going over this. If everybody nods at once, then this gets quick. If somebody doesn't, we're going about to find out. All right. The next one is July 16 and 17th, and that's me and it's Peterson and McWhorter. Right?
Yes.
Yep.
Yep.
And the next one is August 21, 22, and that's Lamb and Wardell.
Correct.
And the next one is September 10th and 11th, and that's me and McWhorter.
Right, and I was going to ask you offline, didn't get a chance, if we could slide that one or two days later in the week. I have a potential Monday conflict that I'd like to accommodate, if you can.
Which date is that?
September 10th and 11th, if we could go to the 11th
and 12th.
You can
slide it anywhere you want, and I'm okay. You want to just name it and we'll do it.
11th and 12th will be fine.
So 11 and 12 is better for you?
Yes.
So let's consider it done. I assume that Hector doesn't have any problem with sliding that one day. Although it's fair to say that the outage doesn't begin until the last 2 days of September, so that's still pre-outage. Okay? Hold on. I'm going to play this back. September 11 and 12, it's me and McWhorter. All right?
Correct.
Next is the public meeting in October. That's a year from now. And we have chosen 23 and 24. Correct?
Yes.
Okay, so all that's done. Now it's time to schedule the next three or four. Because that's what we always do, to try to get three or four, you know, months in advance. So the next one would be November sometime. And that's looks like it's going to be... Peterson and
Furman. I'm usually December.
What?
I'm usually December. November is mid-semester. So, who generally does November?
Pierre, you ended up with May and July.
Bob, you're usually Mr. November.
Yeah, I'm doing September. That's okay. Okay.
Well, Pierre, we put you in May and in July. You had two back-to-back, so to speak.
Oh, did I?
No. That's what made the schedule change.
That's why this is a lot of...
Oh, okay. Well...
I'm not complaining. I'll do November.
December is definitely preferable. I can't remember precisely why it was we switched those around. I think it was somebody else had... Oh, it was Bob needed, at any rate. But
I'm not complaining. I'll do November. This is a year from now.
Yep, with me.
And it's probably the first week or the second week. Okay?
Yep.
The third week is shot for me. So you want to pick... Who am I doing this with? Oh, I'm doing this with
me.
With Furman, right?
Yep. How about 5 and 6 or 6 and 7? 6 and 7. 5 is election day.
November 6 and 7?
Mm-hmm.
Done. Okay.
Okay. So then that suggests that December...
December is going to be Per Peterson and McWhorter.
And would, like, the 10th and 11th be okay?
That works for me.
Okay, let's go ahead and block out 10th and 11th, because that should work from my side.
Okay, and now we're coming up to, wait a minute, we're coming up to 2020, and we're going to schedule the first couple of months there, all right? So January 2020, it looks like it's Lamb and Furman.
Yep. I suggest January 29th to, and no, that's New Year. I suggest January 22nd and 23rd.
How about the week before that?
That week I am engaged.
How about the week before that? 7 and 8? 8 and 9?
No.
No?
Well, the first 3 weeks of January, I probably would not be here.
Well, that gets hard.
Maybe, Bob, maybe
well,
you
what
are...
about 29 and 30th?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, 29 and 30 works okay.
Yeah. Let's hold on, 29 and 30th then.
You're talking about January 29th and 30th, 2020.
2020.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that's Lamb and Wardell.
And yep. Wardell.
Okay, and then the last thing we're going to do is we're going to schedule the public meeting for February, and then we'll be done with this, okay? Well, with you being at the end of January, we don't want the public meeting to be the next week.
No.
Maybe the 19th and 20th or the 26th,
or the
27th?
12th and 13th are in there somewhere?
Yeah.
12th and 13th is right before Valentine's Day. I'm not sure whether that it's right before Valentine's Day.
Well, I don't know. Last time I looked, Valentine's Day is on the 14th, and we would be doing this on the 11th and 12th.
But one of the considerations for doing it slightly later, like the 19th and 20th, was that it gave a little more breathing room to get that last fact-finding report.
I'm not complaining, just asking. On the other hand, February 17th is the President's Day.
That is true. Any of the dates are fine for me.
All right, so if you want to do the public meeting then, I want to strongly suggest it Wednesday, Thursday, not Tuesday, Wednesday.
No, we can do the week before. It's fine.
19, 20, or 12, 13?
Whichever, it doesn't
Peter,
matter.
Are you okay then?
I'm sorry, I wasn't...
We're talking about February 2020.
February 2020.
And we're talking about the week of the 10th through 14th, or the week of the 17th, and we're talking about in the middle of those weeks.
Wednesday, Thursday.
12th and 13th works for me.
Works for me.
Okay. All right, 12 and 13 works for me.
Really?
Yes, 12 and 13.
Yes. Okay, so here's what I'm writing down. February 12th and 13th, 2020. And, of course, with that one, as always, we want to give Hector Garcia a chance to say that there's something going on that we need to know about. By the way, one example would be maybe NSOC's coming that week or something, and we would like to know.
Speaking of which, we could use the NSOC dates, an update on the NSOC dates.
Okay, so now I have a question for somebody in the room, I don't know who. The engagement panel typically meets in the last week of every month, right?
They are not here anymore.
No, that's okay. But I noticed that our public meeting in October 2019, which is a year from now, is exactly the same days as here we are, 23rd, 24th. And maybe the engagement panel is going to be meeting right then, and maybe that's good and maybe that's bad. What do you think?
It's not good.
Well, let's get their schedule first before we decide.
So we want to move it up 1 week to be the 16th and 17th?
No, that doesn't work for me.
Then let's just leave it like it is.
We could move it back.
If we occasionally overlap, then that would actually be beneficial.
Okay.
If we overlap, that gives us all a chance to go to their meeting mm-hmm. without having to make a special trip.
And one thought I had on that is I think we kind of got ourselves into having a public tour and the decommission, the engagement panel on the same day.
Maybe that's too much.
Yes, we could. If we're going to end up on the same day, the decommissioning panel, let's not do a public tour on that day.
Okay.
is probably the better solution.
We'll worry about that a year from now. Okay, so with that, I'm gonna play back the new ones that we scheduled that aren't on our current schedule. November 6th and 7th, 2019, that's a fact-finding with me and Wardell. December 10th and 11th, 2019, fact-finding, Peterson and McWhorter. January 29 and 30, 2020, fact-finding, Lamb and Wardell. Public meeting, February 12th and 13th, 2020. Everybody got this? Everybody got that the same?
Yep.
Okay. Okay.
I have one other question on
that. We've done that tentative to, if Hector comes back and says, gee, there's a conflict, we'll correct.
Right. Okay. I have one other question on committee activities, and that would be whether we want to do a public tour in February or not. We've done the last two times we've met. And we've had some back and forth about the merits of doing them every time. My suggestion would be to not do a public tour in February.
I think given that we did not have a huge turnout this time, that probably alternating would be fine.
So we've got two. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
we're going to have over half an hour.
Yeah.
Half an
hour. Yes. Yeah.
That's, kind of really that's one.
I can be sure. That's just a couple minutes, yeah.
I'm on board on that.
Yeah, that makes it unanimous.
Okay.
So
thank
no
you.
Public tour on what? Which public meeting?
February, which is 4 months
the
from
next one. Okay, sure.
No. Okay, I'm going to call that agenda item to a close unless anybody in the public has a comment or anybody else has a comment. And we're going to hear from Hector later as he checks to make sure that we haven't inadvertently crisscrossed some PG&E thing that we need to know about. Okay.
While we're on dates, can you get us all the key dates for next year?
Yeah, yes, I'll provide you the key dates as well, and I'll go back and look at these dates in our plan calendar.
Okay, thank you.
Well, we can't ask for more than that. Thank you. Okay, so I'm going to call that agenda item to a close. The next agenda item is called documents provided to the committee, and I can do that one or Rob can. There's a list of them in here.
White pages.
They're the white pages in the back of here, and anybody that wants them that doesn't have that can notify one of us, and we'll send them to you by email. We have this list available for the public, okay? That was a 30-second item.
Good job.
Right?
Yes.
The next agenda item is item 8A, and I'm going to call on Furman Wardell to do a report on the fact-finding that was in July of 2018, which meaning 3 months ago. Okay, we're moving along.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It's hard.
Well, that helps that you're going to be able to have dinner.
Right, and you want this to be a 20-minute presentation, did I hear you say?
Whatever you need.
Let me describe.
We're going to adjourn, come hell or high water, at 5:15. What we have left is your presentation and public comment on it, and then Rick's. We have two fact findings. Mm-hmm. So you can keep yours to 30 minutes, including Q&A, so it's a little less.
Okay. On the screen is the agenda. I'm not going to read that right now, but I'm going to have a slide for each agenda item so we can follow that as I go along. This was a fact finding meeting back in July with Per Peterson and myself. And the slides are not forwarding. You can forward them manually if you want to. Oh, there we go. Good. Thank you. First item we looked at was the two things, the annual radioactive release report and the environmental monitoring report. Those two reports that PG&E sends in annually to the NRC, which documents radiation releases, planned or otherwise, and there were no otherwises this year. They're all planned and measured. This slide shows you the level of liquid and gaseous. These are calculated based on what's measured leaving the plant. And the right-hand column shows you the percent of technical specifications. So that's put percentages out besides those, 0.0066 and the number below that. So the very, very low fractions of what's permitted, very small radiation releases. At the bottom, also measured is the accumulated direct radiation dose. This is direct radiation, not liquids or gases or things like that. At the site boundary where the closest person could be, if that person was there 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and that person would have received 1 millirem, which is a very small amount, and compare this to 310 millirem, which is the annual average radiation exposure to someone in the U.S. That's a little low. I've heard numbers as high as 600, depending on where one lives. Basically, since the plant operating started, there have been no increases, really, in the background levels measured around the plant. We looked also at the this generic issue, containment sump debris, and the history here is in 2004, the NRC issued a generic letter, you read the title there, Assessment of Debris Accumulation. Diablo County increased the size of their containment sump twice. They also performed some analyses and chemical assessments as far as chemicals that it would be in the bottom of the containment in the effect of a loss of coolant accident and the effect that might have on water recirculation and cooling. This issue is about to close. It's about a year away from closing. And you can see under remaining DCPP items, Diablo Canyon has some calculations to complete, some design changes, which really are not physical design changes, but they're incorporating the calculations into their design bases. They're referencing a WCAP report. That's a Westinghouse topical report, which has been approved by NRC, or will be approved soon. And once they issue the design plan change package, then the NRC can issue a closure letter. We expect this to happen by September of next year, so about a year from now. We feel like this issue will be closed. It's been going for a long time. It's an important issue, but it's a very complex issue. Back in May, the fact-finding team talked to the system engineering management, and among other things, they found that there was some turnover in the system engineering staff. Turnover typically was people transferring to other parts of the station, for example, operations, maybe maintenance, maybe a few leaving the organization, retiring. So we followed up on that in the July fact-finding meeting just to see what they're doing about that. And they're doing a number of things. One, they're increasing the hiring efforts, and including relying more on the summer intern program, which they get a lot of hires. A lot of those are Cal Poly students and other colleges in the vicinity or in the state where there are summer interns, and they end up working permanently at the plant. Works out very good for them, for both sides, both company and the employees. Some other things they're doing organizationally are they're bringing the new engineers into a career engineering program, which gives them a diverse base that moves them around in the first couple of years to various parts of the engineering organization, excuse me, in the plant, and gives them a very nice, broad, diverse base from which to jump into their first permanent assignment. They're expanding the EFIN, which is the Engineering Fix Now group. This is a group that tackles small problems, emergent problems, that the system engineers had been doing. But they're small problems, and the specialized Fix It Now team can do those quickly and take the load off the system engineers. They're also reducing the administrative burden on the system engineers, report writing, forms, that sort of thing. Expanding component engineering. This is assigning engineers to various components as to various systems, for example, pumps or valves, as opposed to a full system. And this is also helping to take the load off the system engineers. And finally, they're looking ahead more critically at future staffing needs. So they're in good shape as far as their system engineer staffing goes. We looked at a quality verification assessment of the 2R20 outage. And one thing they found a few small things, but one thing we want to follow up on is the fact that the operators, they didn't, quality did not think they were taking appropriate actions to verify equipment configurations. In other words, the equipment's taken out of service and put back in service. They weren't taking procedural actions fully to verify the configurations. So quality verification jacked that up to something called an area requiring management attention. They put it in the corrective action program. While we were there in July, they had not completed the actions on correcting that, so we'll follow up. I believe we'll follow up in December on that. Back in May, our fact-finding team looked at the workplace seismic safety, something we like to look at periodically. This basically encompasses tall bookcases, other things that could, in a seismic event, fall over on a plant employee or block plant employees' access to a critical area. So they found some deficiencies back in May. In July, we looked at those deficiencies and talked to them. All had been corrected. And we found out the deficiencies were caused by personnel turnover in the building services area where they didn't have adequate knowledge transfer. They should have done that because there is a plant policy that describes what they're supposed to be doing. So they've got a formal program in place, and we feel like that's been corrected. But Per and I will be looking at that actually in May. I think we're going to follow that up in May. But they fixed these particular things.
Let's hope.
What?
Let's hope. Hope springs eternal.
That's why we keep following up. We then observed something called a site alignment workshop, and this is a workshop. In this case, Hector Garcia was a facilitator with about 10 participants, I believe, around the table. And it's a focus. All employees are going through this, and it's to get employees aligned to the their excellence program or their goals, the DCPP goals and expectations. Item three, those are the subjects that Hector facilitated, safety, people, liability, you can read all the others. Those are the main items in the operating plan for the station. So it was a good discussion, a lot of discussion there, a lot of examples given, and I thought the employees took it pretty well and learned a lot about how they align to the station goals. Yes, Bob?
I'm just noticing that under the last item, it says you're supposed to support six focus areas, and I see seven bullets. And I'm real good at counting to seven.
I think safety is probably one I threw in there because all meetings have a safety discussion.
It's okay. I was just amused.
So
I was amused, that's all.
The last bullet is not a focus area, but that's really what the station's priority is.
That's fine.
But it's not a focus area.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Good catch, Bob. I don't know why you didn't catch that when I sent the written report out the first time. You're usually pretty good at it.
I probably
that.
Did. I don't remember.
No, you didn't. Let's see what happened here. We lost my next slide. There you go. Thank you. We met with Jan Nimick, High Station Management, Senior Director of Nuclear Services, and we talked about the system engineering staffing, which I just talked about, the employee retention plan. We got an update on that, and that was good news. That was actually before that Bill 1090 went through, got approved. But nevertheless, they were still having success with their retention plan. We gave them our experience on the workplace seismic safety, which I just covered. We talked a little bit about the role of our committee as far as following the shutdown in 2025. Didn't come to any conclusions, just to let him know we're working on it, what our ideas were. And then, of course, we mentioned to him the site alignment workshop, which I just covered. Those meetings are pretty useful for back and forth conversation and ideas. We also met with the NRC Senior Resident Inspector. We try to do this at each fact-finding meeting. We mentioned to him our experience, which I just covered on GSI 191, that they were aligned with that hopefully that'll be closed out in about a year from now. We talked about our long-term role, again, like we did with Jan Nimick. He explained to us a little bit about the NRC Office of Decommissioning, which we just heard about a few minutes ago. He mentioned that the public meeting, NRC's public meeting, would be on August 28th. And both the NRC and our committee are interested in Diablo Canyon employee engagement. Are they engaged in their work? Are they doing their work safely? That sort of thing. That's something we're both monitoring. And especially with the joint proposal, we're taking a close look at employee engagement and staffing. Preventive maintenance optimization, which I'll refer to as PMO, there's an initiative that started at Diablo Canyon, and most other nuclear plants too right now, by the way. It's a cost savings thing and personnel savings as well. Diablo has a little over 12,000 preventive maintenance activities. These are procedures, tests, other sort of things that they do and all the components out there. That's a lot. Their point is they want to optimize these activities by reviewing them all with a cross-discipline team to see whether are they still needed, is the frequency appropriately established, and is the scope correct for safety or reliability. They expect to complete this this month, and we're going to follow up on that pair, I believe, or you can do that in November. Either November or December.
I think you're doing it.
I think we're doing it in December. And here's just a list of the total maintenance activities that they've reviewed, a little over 8,000. They've changed frequencies in a little over 2,000. They've eliminated 1,148 of them. And they've changed the scope, which probably means they've reduced the scope in a little over 200 of them. So they're making pretty good progress. They have a basis for all these changes. And that's one thing we're going to review in December to see what the bases are like for some examples of these changes. We got a brief update on the independent spent fuel storage installation operations. They were currently in a loading campaign, loading casks 50 through 58. That concluded back in August. It was very successful. They plan the next campaign, I think, in 2020 and then 2021 or 2022. And item two there, you can see they need to start relicensing the ISFACI in 2022. I think it expires in 2025, something like that. They'll be ahead of the game. And one thing we were interested in is stress corrosion cracking, that item number three. That'll be part of their relicensing submittal. Well, they'll have consideration for techniques for detecting stress corrosion cracking and through wall cracks. Yes, Bob?
And when they do the relicensing, which is still several years hence, the site has a new evaluation of the seismic hazard, which they did over the last several years, spent a lot of resources on. And we're going to want to review that to make sure that they've accounted for that and that they're still seismically adequate. And that's a separate review, which is on our open items list.
It's on the list. It's on the open items list?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. We'll cover that whenever we said we would. Finally, with the shutdown coming in 2024 and 2025, we were interested in talking to the nuclear fuel engineers about what their plans were as far as any changes to the fuel cycle. Right now, their fuel cycles have typically been around 18 to 21 months, depending on what year and what season of the year. They're now going to go to item three there, 18-month cycles through the end of plant operation, which will optimize the fuel and the economy of fuel, but really wouldn't have any impact we could find on nuclear safety. So that concludes the report, and I'll be glad to take questions. Oh, by the way, I sent the report out to the committee in August or so, got comments back, sent it out again, and I have received no comments from the second tranche. So I offered it to you for approval, unless there's questions or comments.
Any comments from a committee? Rick? Anybody else? Comments from the public? Sure.
I have a question. Are they doing it every 18 months, the refueling now, because they want to have lower burn-up fuel to deal with at the end of the life of the plant? Sorry.
That's a good question.
Good question. No, the high burn-up doesn't have anything to do with it. Not changing their burn-up schedules. They're just trying to...
If it's less in there, less time, isn't it lower burn-up?
Yes.
Right.
But 18 versus 21 months is not very much change. It's not very much different.
But it is proportional, but yeah. That's not the rationale. The rationale had to do with scheduling them in spring and fall. And as I understood it, maybe one of the PG&E people can comment, the rationale was more trying to make sure about how they scheduled the next, what, they have 6 years to go or something?
It boils down pretty much to schedule, like Bob was saying, into the economics of buying the fuel and getting your maximum burn out of it. But whether it's 18 or 21 months, as far as in burnout goes, it's not that big a deal.
But Furman, your comment, I think, was very important. We're a safety committee. We didn't see that there was any impact in safety. If anything, it'll be, you know, marginally, quote, safer or whatever, but we didn't think that that was an important thing.
Gene Nelson, Californians for Green Nuclear Power. One of the issues with 21-month refueling cycles is that you move your outage into a period of peak demand, and given that the plant
cycles around,
given that the plant provides around 9% or 10% of California's in-state generation, that is a significant concern. We've already come during a refueling outage last year. We actually had the California Independent System Operator declare, I think, something like a, it was like a stage one emergency because a heat wave hit.
Fair comment.
At the time of the refueling outage.
Thank you. Any other comments from the committee?
Yep.
Want to have a motion to accept the report?
I'd like to move that the report be accepted as presented.
I'll second that motion.
Okay, and then of course it passes.
All in favor? Aye.
I agree. The implication of that is it's now, it will be available to the public, and then it's going to go into our next annual report. Okay. The next item on the agenda is Rick McWhorter is going to talk about a fact-finding on April 22 and April 23.
Thank you, Dr. Budness. This is a report on fact-finding for Dr. Lamb and myself, August 22nd and 23rd. Our first item on the agenda was the meeting with the NRC resident inspector. We met the senior resident, Chris Newport. Several of the items we talked about are mentioned here. A couple of items worth noting. They had an new unresolved item on what's called emissions times used in operability evaluations. That has to do with when a piece of equipment is declared inoperable, how long that they can be without that piece of equipment before it actually affects the safety function. The problem is the question is more about what documents those times and how they pull those times out of the design basis documentation for use and operability evaluations. No indication there's a safety concern there at this time, but the NRC has opened an unresolved item until they understand it and have more clarity on that item. As Furman mentioned, preventive maintenance optimization program has been ongoing, and we've been reviewing that. The NRC has also been reviewing that as well. They have similar concern to make sure that the any reduction in maintenance activities is appropriate. The second item on our agenda was we observed a licensed operator continuing training class. This is a routine class. The licensed operators and non-licensed operators as well are broken up into five crews. As part of their regularly rotating schedule of shift assignments, they spend 1 week in training and the licensed operator continuing training class every 5 to 6 weeks, about 10 to 12 weeks of training a year. This entire program is accredited by the Institute for Nuclear Power Operations. INPO is a very structured, formal program. And part of our open items list is to monitor operator training on a regular basis. So we set in on the class. In this case, the topic was the new emergency action level scheme that's actually was used today in the exercise for the first time. It was implemented in August 22nd of this year, 27th, excuse me, and we actually saw the last class going through training on that prior to its implementation. This is a change to the classification schemes. They come from an NEI, Nuclear Energy Institute, guidance document that's approved by the NRC, or that they structure their emergency plan around that guidance document and submit it to the NRC for its approval. That was approved early in the year, and they were implementing that on August 27th. The presentation involved the use of the emergency action level wall chart, which is a very detailed chart that's used to classify an emergency and determine which is the right classification, like an alert, site area emergency, or general emergency. It's used a flowchart to determine how many fission product barriers are threatened or have been breached to make the appropriate classification. It's in the form of a wall chart because that classification has to be done usually within 15 minutes. So you want a quick way to work through that. But also accompanying the wall chart is a basis document that gives you all the details. If you need to go to any one point and find out more of the details, that's available. So the instructor worked through the wall chart and the basis document, explaining to all the operators the appropriate way to work through that, how to do it using the proper human performance tools and conservative decision making. And this is kind of the environment that we're talking about, the picture of the training class here. What's that? No, that's the wall chart would be one panel of it's right there, and one section of it's right there on the desk that we're looking at. There are actually, I think, two panels about that size. In the control room and the emergency centers, those are typically under glass or on the wall. In the control room, it's under a piece of glass on the desk. The training class was very well conducted, and the instructor was obviously well prepared, and noticed that there was appropriate interaction with the class, asking questions and back and forth, and appropriate focus on the objectives. Following this class, we also had lunch with another portion of the shift over another classroom. As an experienced person in all types of power generation, nuclear, non-nuclear, if you want to really know what's going on, give an operator a free lunch and ask him how it's going, and they'll shoot straight with you. We did that, and we learned, we had a good dialogue with some of the operation staff that we had learned they're generally very satisfied with their jobs and certainly have no safety concerns, are very proud of the safety record at Diablo Canyon and the success of their operations. They are very concerned about retention for the future for licensed operators, particularly in the second tranche of the retention bonuses. They question how effective those will be to retain the staff necessary. And, you know, only time will tell, but just they question, you know, what will happen when the time comes to sign up for those second tranches.
I think, if I may add, I think that lunch was a very informative exercise. We both, Mr. McHalter and I, had free and open exchanges of opinion with the license operators on numerous issues that are not on our agenda, such as career planning, you know, where would they go from here before the plan and after the plan shut down. So we find that very informative. And one of the things that the team was sensitive to was, is there any subtle signal that we could detect about operational staff morale with the pending plant closure.
All right, our next topic on the agenda was review of Learning Services Department performance. That's the training department, essentially. Overall learning to services, as indicated on the performance indicators, is in a green or healthy status for the program. That's an improvement from white, where it has been for the last few years, and the major change that they were able to get out of white and into green was that several long-standing issues with the simulator had been resolved by virtue of software and other upgrades on the simulator.
Yeah.
We also talked about the Learning Services Excellence Plan. This is the plan that many of the departments at the station have to improve performance, to quantify the initiatives they want to take to improve performance or address issues, and it comprised of several action steps that they intend to take over the next year to two years in general. A couple of items of interest that were focus areas. There is an NRC requalification inspection next spring. As a part of that, there is a pilot program for working with the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations to pilot some changes to the recall examination process. That'll be happening this month, and then will be affecting the inspection in the spring. They're also working to improve the expert instructor development program. Instructors are qualified. There's a formal qualification program. It takes about a year to complete. But beyond that, there's another program to develop further expertise as instructors to increase the depth of the instructor knowledge and their ability to teach in certain areas. So that's kind of the second level of development for the instructors that they're focusing on beyond the initial qualification. We talked about staff turnover in the department. It's a routine question we ask now whenever we talk to departments at the station. There has been some turnover. The supervisory force has been relatively stable, but otherwise they've had slightly more turnover than planned in the form of unplanned losses. About 4 out of the 60 instructors in the department were unplanned, either separations or retirements in the last year. They are working on a plan to develop a long-term staffing plan for the department. This is the department that will ramp down over time as cessation of operations approaches. Probably the biggest example of that is that at some point there will be no more initial operator license classes, and there will be no longer a requirement to have the staffing to support them. But that plan has not fully been laid out yet, but they are working on that, of how that department will reduce in force over the time leading up to the cessation of operations. We also touched briefly on the initial licensed operator class for next year. They are gearing up for that. The Learning Services Department is working with operations to recruit people for that class. There's a goal to try to put as many as 24 people into the class for licensing. They are having some difficulty filling all those positions at the time of our meeting, but they still have some time to see if they can manage to do that. Overall, we concluded the Learning Services Department performance was good, and it was appropriately focused on maintaining excellence in the training services during this period of significant transition and challenges coming up. Next item on our agenda was a review of the NFPA 805 program, National Fire Protection Association. We've talked about this a lot over the last few years. Primary purpose of this visit was to confirm that the transition to the NFPA 805 program had been completed as scheduled in the middle part of this year, and we did confirm that was the case. There were two major sections to the completion of that. The first was completing the physical training changes on Unit 2, and that was completed in Unit 2 refueling outage this last spring. And then the second was the programmatic changes, the final programmatic changes following that outage on Unit 2 to implement that program, and that was completed in June of this year. There is some effort ongoing to work on closeout of documents. The program is essentially fully implemented, but they are primarily focused now on making the documents kind of more organized, preparing a matrix of all the documents. There's about 900 documents that are basis documents for the program and its that they've transitioned to now. The matrix will, you know, show for this issue, here are the basis documents, here's how you go and find the information that you need to manage the program in detail. And then they're focused also on getting ready for the NRC inspection, which is now occurring here in this month. So a regular triennial fire protection inspection the NRC does every 3 years. This will be the first inspection following the NFPA 805 program implementation. And as we talked earlier today, we have plans to review this issue, or just review of fire protection in general after the first of the year. But we'll know the results of that inspection and find out what the NRC thinks of their implementation of the program. Our conclusion here is that the station has satisfactorily completed its implementation of the program with all the physical modifications and all the programmatic processes. Next topic on the agenda, Dr. Lamb met with Vice President and Chief Nuclear Officer, Mr. Jim Welts. They talked about various topics, which I am not knowledgeable, but I'm sure were appropriate. If you have any comments.
Right. We had a one-hour meeting at the CNO's office, primarily talk about what is the current CNO's office priorities. Okay, and his priorities clearly it's at many different elements. One, two of which is, again, the continuation of the joint proposal implementation and the decommissioning of engagement panel. So the plan is keeping track of current developments, and I consider these priorities well placed.
Next item on our agenda was the review of the Operating Experience Program. I've got several items that we're looking at just as a matter of routine. This is one of them. The Operating Experience Program is the way that the site manages operating experience notifications. There are about 25 to 50 operating experience notification event reports come in per week. Those reports come mostly from the IMPO Consolidated Event Reporting System, ICES. But it also comes from other sources, from the NRC, from vendors, from peer committees, engineering, news back and forth between different plants. Anything that comes into the site is entered into a Operating Experience Report OE database that is managed by the OE coordinator. Each report is forwarded to a subject matter expert who reviews the report initially, determines if it's applicable to Diablo Canyon. If it is, well, the results of that review, the subject matter expert review, is recorded in the database so that there's all, for each of these, there's a record of what was done with the disposition. If it is applicable, the subject matter expert submits a notification into the system, the SAP system, for further review, and those reviews have to be completed within 60 days to determine what is the applicability and what are the corrective actions. There are a few OE events that would be of extreme high priority that might come in during the year, and those would follow a slightly different path of higher priority in processing, but this is the fundamental process that's used. The overall program is green and has been functioning well. There was an issue identified this year with the programmatic issues from several years ago during the turnover between OE coordinators that was recently came to light, and they had to go back and review some notifications. But no significant issues were identified out of that. Our conclusion was that the station continues to manage an effective operating experience and review program. Next item on the agenda was, again, a more routine review item of the MIDAS system, the Meteorological Information and Dose Assessment System. This is the software that's used to make protective action recommendations if an accidental radiation release were to occur in an emergency. Software would be used on a day like it was the emergency exercise today to take information from the weather and information from radiation monitors, information gathered from field monitoring teams, put them into the software package and determine this sector of the county could be subject to radiation certain levels and we should take action to shelter in place or evacuate people in that area. So this is the software that's used for that by the station. This software has basically been the same software in use since 2015. There's really only been minor fixes and updates completed. There have been some changes to the equipment that provides input. Several upgrades have been performed there, particularly in the radiation detection area. We did talk a little bit about differences between this system and RASCL, which is a system used by the county as well as the NRC. They do come up with sometimes with different outputs, slightly different outputs, but that's not considered a bad thing. The MIDAS system is very site-specific, uses site-specific meteorological data, whereas RASCL uses National Weather Service data, so slightly different inputs will result in slightly different outputs. But both kind of serve the purpose to provide information to decision makers at the county about evacuation and such. That process is a judgment process made by people who are trained to do that. It's not an automatic process. They're an input to decision making. So slight differences are not a major issue. We talked about training and qualification for people on the system, and there are about 20 people that maintain qualifications to operate the system, and that's divided up between the four emergency response teams that are assigned at the station. Conclusion on this is that the MIDAS system continues to be properly maintained and is ready for use in the event of an emergency. Next item on our agenda was Chemistry Department performance. We met with Chemistry Department manager chemistry and environmental operations manager, actually. Overall chemistry department performance indicators have been green. That's driven by mostly by numeric indicators that actually measure the performance of chemistry in the plant. Primary one is the secondary chemistry effective indicator, the CEI, which has been green and near zero for many months. This represents the fact that the feed water that goes into the steam generators is being maintained very clean, and minimal inputs, minimal deposits are being generated in the steam generators. That's also evidenced by when they open the secondary side of the steam generators during the outages, finding very low levels of sludge in the steam generators. Also on the primary chemistry side, that's reactor coolant chemistry, there were no major issues identified, and that chemistry has been fairly stable. We ask about staffing for the department. They are fully staffed. They have had some turnover. It is another department that would anticipate being eliminated, essentially, at the point that operations cease, so that would be a concern for what's going to happen over the next few years. Conclusion, again, is that the chemistry department performance remains good, and the department was maintaining proper primary and secondary chemistry. Last item on our agenda was a review of reactor coolant system health. Reactor coolant system is the system that we talk about quite frequently that transfer heat from the reactor to the steam generators to generate steam for use in the turbines. It serves to do that heat transfer, as well as it's one of the primary pressure boundaries for radiation, preventing a radiation release. It's a second barrier against release of fission products. At the last review by the committee, there were some issues identified. RCP seals were one, reactor coolant pump seals. That's kind of a separate area that we'll review again. Actually, it's on our agenda to review in November. But we're all aware that there has been some major changeouts of reactor coolant pump seals over the last few years, and the performance of those seals in general have been improved. There's also an issue with pressurizer safety valve leakage during startups. This is caused by, as the temperature increases of the plant during startup, the safety valves start to weep a little liquid. After many years of dealing with this issue, they hired a third-party consulting firm to come in and do a very detailed analysis, and their conclusion was that this leakage was caused by stress of the tailpipe from the safety valve, thermal expansion of the tailpipe, putting stress on the safety valve. On unit two, they did a modification during this last outage to reconfigure the tailpipes to better accommodate thermal expansion. And they did not have any significant leakage problems on startups. They consider that a success. And we'll be installing a similar modification on Unit 1 in the next outage. Overall, the system today is classified as white, acceptable, but improvements are still desired. Several known issues here that are driving that, known that they're not new to us. One is the fact they found flaws in the RHR penetrations on the reactor coolant system in both units that have had to have ASME Section 11 evaluations and exemption requests submitted and reviewed. Until those welds overlays are complete on both units, that will continue to be tracked. An issue on the system currently is the RCP vibration monitoring system, its age, its retention of data, and that system is being scheduled for replacement. An ongoing basis there to upgrade it to a more modern system. And there was a recent issue from the NRC combined design basis inspection where the power operator relief valves, the electrical cables going to them were found to not meet equipment qualification guidelines for post-accident environment and containment. Specifically, they did not have loops in the conduits such that water running down would drip off the conduit and not run into the electrical connection on those valves. So that's an issue that's been identified, and they are working on correcting. Our conclusion is the reactor coolant system health is acceptable with emerging issues that are being pursued for resolution. That completes my report, and I would submit and ask for committee's approval.
Thank you very much. Any comments from the committee? Furman? Any comments from the public?
Gene Nelson, Californians for Green Nuclear Power. I recently attended the American Nuclear Society's, there's a utility working group meeting.
Speak up.
What?
Speak up.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay, so I recently attended the American Nuclear Society's Utilities Working Conference in Fernandina Beach, Florida. And one of the interesting exhibits that I saw from a vendor was about how static electricity when you're using a three-phase drive to run a pump, that can somehow, there are mechanisms whereby that can cause erosion of pump seals. And I just wanted to alert the committee to that rather curious phenomenon. Apparently, they're still studying it, but a vendor has proposed a solution to it.
Thank you. Thank you. That's very helpful. Any other comments? Hearing none, I'll entertain a motion to accept the report.
I so move.
Peter?
I'll second.
Okay, and so that report is accepted. And like the other one, it's having been accepted, it's now going to be publicly available, and it'll go into our annual report in due course. We only have one more agenda item. It's very short. Rob Wellington's going to talk about administrative, regulatory, and legal matters, but it'll be a short report. And then we're going to adjourn until 8:30 tomorrow morning. Go ahead, Rob.
Just on the with regard to our public outreach, we have recently updated the informational brochure and also the informational video. And it's the video we saw today was not the one that's been updated. It's been updated, just it isn't ready for public publication. As most of you know, in September, Senate Bill 1090 passed, and that included part of that bill included restoring full funding to the Employees Retention Program, which is a part of that bill that we had expressed some interest in. And then finally, just to I've passed out to you, it's always of sort of interest to the committee, is the report on all of the unique hits that arrive at our website. And to note that since the last meeting, there's been an average of 930 unique hits on our website, and the top five countries from which they have been received include the United States, Canada, Uzbekistan, Russia, of course, and Germany, in that order.
Yeah, well, I've got a...
That's all I have.
I go to Uzbekistan every Tuesday, and I've been hitting the site just to up the number. Okay, hearing no other comments about that or anything, we're about to adjourn this meeting, and we're going to resume here tomorrow morning at 8:30 with the remainder of the agenda. So I'm going to call this meeting adjourned. But before I do, I want to thank our ABP support. We couldn't do it without you, and it really makes a difference. And I want to say that when I go later, like next week, and go and look, it's great. You know, and so I do that just to make sure that members of the public can go and look, and it's great, and it really is. So we're very thankful, and keep up the good work. Meeting adjourned tomorrow morning at 8:30. And thank you, Hector. Thank you.